Anyhow, the books. Are you seeing the books? Everything you would want to read is right here. Feel it. Feels good, right? Now smell it. Nothing smells like that.
I'm sorry, excuse me. Did I just see you smell that book?
Dear Reader, Season 2. Brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Episode 3, Showtime. Greetings and salutations to the third episode of Dear Reader, Season 2, a limited series looking at the controversial play The Women by Claire Booth Luce and its three cinematic adaptations. I am your guide to spilling the tea, Stella. In the season premiere, I examine the source material to give us a foundation for the remaining episodes of the season, and that episode also helps us determine whether an adaptation follows the law of the women or the spirit of the women. As always, there is no continuity for this show, but episode 1 gives all of the context. In this episode, I am looking at the 1956 Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, The Opposite Sex. The Opposite Sex was released on the 26th of October, 1956, and it was in production from the 6th of February to the 23rd of May, 1956. Sound was done by Westrex Recording System, color is Metrocolor, and its widescreen ratio is CinemaScope. It runs 115 to 117 minutes. Its length in feet is 10,458 and in reels, 14. It stars June Allison as Kay Ashley Hilliard, Joan Collins as Crystal Allen, Dolores Gray as Sylvia Fowler, Ann Sheridan as Amanda Penrose, Ann Miller as Gloria Dahl, Leslie Nielsen as Stephen Hilliard, Jeff Richards as Buck Winston, Agnes Moorehead as the Countess, Charlotte Greenwood as Lucy, Joan Blondell as Edith Potter, Sam Levine as Mike Pearl, Bill Goodwin as Howard Fowler, Alice Pierce as Olga, Vera Vague as Dolly DeHaven, Sandy Desher as Debbie Hilliard, Carolyn Jones as Pat, Jerry Antes as leading man dancer, Alan Marshall as Ted, Jonathan Hole as Phelps Potter. The production company was Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Corp. and Lowe's Inc., and the distribution company is Lowe's Inc., directed by David Miller and assistant director George Rain, produced by Joe Pasternak. Screenwriters were Faye Cannon and Michael Cannon, director of photography Robert Bronner, and assistant camera Robert Ion. Art directors are Cedric Gibbons and Daniel B. Cathcart. Film editor John McSweeney Jr. Set decorators Edwin B. Willis, Henry Grace, and Dorothy Hammerstein. Costumes done by Helen Rose. The music supervisor is George Stoll. In the orchestra, we have Albert Sendry and Skip Martin. The vocal supervisor, Robert Tucker. Music coordinator, Irving Aronson. Recording director for There's Gold in the Trees, Eddie Freeman, and also Joe Carnes. The recording supervisor is Dr. Wesley C. Miller, and then sound editors are Kendrick Kinney, John Lipow, and Walter Marsh. Special effects by A. Arnold Gillespie and Warren Newcomb. Dances and musical numbers staged by Robert Sidney. Hairstyles done by Sidney Gilleroff. Makeup created by William Tuttle. Joan Collins' makeup by Frank Perhoda. And June Allison's makeup by Stanley Smith. Singing voice double for June Allison on A Perfect Love, Joan Greer. And singing voice double for Jeff Richards, Johnny O'Neill. The color consultant was Charles K. Hagedon. The songs included in this film are There's Golden in the Trees, The Opposite Sex, A Perfect Love, Now Baby Now, and Rock and Roll Tumbleweed, music by Nicholas Brodsky, lyrics by Sammy Kahn. Young Man with a Horn, music by George Stoll, and lyrics by Reed. The songwriters and composers were Nicholas Brodsky, Sam Kahn, Ralph Reed, and George Stoll. The genre of The Opposite Sex is musical comedy, and the subgenre is show business. For the major subjects, divorce, New York City, gold diggers, revenge, gossip, infidelity, and wives. For the minor subjects, charity, cowboys, gossip columnists, reconciliation, seduction, wedding anniversaries, chorus girls, fist fights, mothers and daughters. I scoff at that for sure. Reno, Nevada. Singers, women ranchers, class distinction, friendship, nightclubs, ranches, salons, and theatrical producers. Some history of this production. The on-screen screenwriting credit reads screenplay by Faye and Michael Cannon. The opening and closing cast credits vary slightly in order. A written foreword reads Manhattan Island, a body of land consisting of 4 million square miles completely surrounded by women. Throughout the film, Anne Sheridan provides voiceover narration as her character. That's incorrect. It's not throughout the film. Amanda Penrose. Modern sources state that MGM originally considered Grace Kelly for the role of Kate Ashley Hilliard. In May 1955, Daily Variety announced that MGM was preparing The Opposite Sex for Esther Williams. By August 1955, according to a Hollywood Reporter news item, the studio planned to star Doris Day and Howard Keel in the film, but later cast Eleanor Parker in the lead role. As noted in a 29th of November 1955 Hollywood Reporter item, Parker refused the role, citing her desire to rest after a strenuous two-year schedule, and was subsequently placed under suspension by MGM. A December 1955 Rambling Reporter piece on Hollywood Reporter stated that Peter Graves was considered for the role of Buck Winston. And as of 19th of February 1956, a Los Angeles Times article about the film included Vivian Siegel in the cast as Countess. In March 1956, however, Hollywood Reporter noted that Siegel withdrew from the production because, quote, the broadness of the script characterization was too pronounced for her, end quote. And the role was taken over by Agnes Moorehead. Although a 13th of January 1956 Hollywood Reporter news item adds Arthur O'Connell to the cast, he did not appear in the final film. Another Hollywood Reporter news item states that dancer Roberta Lane was cast, but her appearance in the film has not been confirmed. Dolores Gray sang the title song over the opening credits. According to a 26th of April Hollywood Reporter item, the titles were to run over 5 pantomime vignettes written by Sammy Kahn, but no vignettes were seen in the viewed print. Contemporary sources note that some scenes were filmed on location in New York City. An article in the October 1956 issue of Cosmopolitan claimed that Joan Collins attracted a severe allergy to bath bubbles, making her two bath scenes painful, and that during the scene in which Kay slaps Crystal Allen, June Allison's punch knocked Collins unconscious. Not surprised, since the one we see in the film definitely connects because her earring flies out of her ear. The article added that Allison was paid $3,000 per day for her role in the film. Upon the release of The Opposite Sex, many critics compared the picture unfavorably to the earlier film version, stating that the biting humor of Luce's original play had been lost. In addition, the Motion Picture Daily reviewer expressed disappointment that celebrated entertainers Gray and Ann Miller were not given the opportunity to sing or dance in the film. The film marked Allison's last role at MGM, where she had been a contract player since 1902. And all of this information that I have given you comes from AFI. And finally, before we get into some reviews, let me give you the synopsis from AFI. At Sydney's Salon in Manhattan, society ladies can get a shampoo, set, and the latest gossip, all for one fee. One afternoon, Sylvia Fowler learns from manicurist Olga that theater producer Stephen Hilliard is having an affair with chorus girl Crystal Allen. Although Sylvia and Stephen's wife Kay are friends, Sylvia is thrilled with the scandal and rushes to tell another of their friends, Edith Potter. Despite Sylvia's subsequent hints, Kay remains oblivious to any possible problems with Stephen, to whom she has been loyally married for 10 years. Later, the ladies meet at the 20 One Club to plan their upcoming charity benefit, a theatrical production. While Kay, a former singer, is busy being wooed to return to work by her old agent Mike Pearl, Kay's best friend, acerbic writer Amanda Penrose, rebukes Sylvia and Edith for circulating the gossip about Stephen. When Kay returns, however, Sylvia suggests that she visit Olga for a manicure, and Kay innocently agrees. After lunch, Sylvia and Edith attend Stephen's show to catch sight of Crystal, and although the pregnant Edith's morning sickness forces them to leave, later at a coffee shop they happen to sit next to Crystal and the three exchange barbed remarks. Crystal leaves to call Stephen, who has recently broken off their affair, and although she now urges him to see her again, he refuses. Meanwhile, Kay goes to Sydney's, where Olga, not realizing who she is, repeats the gossip about Stephen. Kay is devastated, but tries to abide by Amanda's advice to pretend nothing is happening until Stephen realizes his mistake and corrects it. That night, however, at the couple's anniversary party, Kay tries to keep up appearances, but when she is asked to sing a love song, she recalls the first time she met Stephen and, breaking down, runs from the room. Soon after, Crystal reads in the paper that Kay has gone to Bermuda, and hoping that this signals a rift in the marriage, arranges to bump into Stephen and the Hilliard's daughter, Debbie, at the park. There, Crystal manipulates Stephen into spending the day together. That night, Kay returns home from Bermuda early, and Stephen is thrilled to see her. At the charity benefit, Kay runs a show, not realizing that Crystal is performing in one of the numbers. When Crystal sees Kay, she plots to confront her and incite her jealousy. As Crystal has hoped, Kay goes to Crystal's dressing room, and after Kay calls her dress cheap, Crystal responds, quote, "When Stephen doesn't like something I wear, I take it off," end quote. Kay slaps her and runs out, and although Stephen tries to follow her, she refuses to listen to his excuses. Soon after, she is on a train to Reno to obtain a divorce. Along the way, she meets the Countess, a colorful older woman on her fourth divorce, and entertainer Gloria Dahl, both of whom help Kay celebrate her new freedom. In Reno, the ladies stay at Lucy's Ranch, where Playboy cowboy Buck Winston distracts Kay momentarily by trying to kiss her. Trying? Yeah, right. Later, at the ranch, Kay is shocked to discover that the newest boarder is Sylvia, whose husband is leaving her for another woman. After reading a newspaper item Edith has mailed, Kay deduces that the other woman is Gloria, prompting Sylvia to initiate a fistfight with Gloria that wrecks the kitchen. Within weeks, Kay's divorce is finalized. Although the Countess and Gloria are solicitous, Kay clearly still pines for Stephen. Amanda shows up to urge her to ask Stephen for a reconciliation, but just then, Stephen calls to inform Kay that he is marrying Crystal. Forced by financial exigency to return to her singing career, Kay, under her maiden name of Ashley, learns backstage that Sylvia has returned from Reno with Buck as her new paramour and is fast friends with Crystal. At the Hilliard home, meanwhile, Crystal has grown bored with Stephen, is habitually nasty to Debbie, and is secretly having an affair with Buck, whom Sylvia is grooming to be, to be a singing star, hoping this will spur her friend's jealousy. The night of Buck's big opening, Kay refuses to join Amanda, the Countess, and Gloria at the club, knowing Stephen will be there with Crystal. Before bed, however, Debbie innocently reveals that Stephen is unhappy and that Crystal is seeing Buck. Inspired, Kay puts on her most beautiful gown and goes to the club, where she greets Stephen charmingly and enlists gossip columnist Dolly DeHaven's help in getting revenge on Sylvia. To do so, Kay follows Sylvia into the ladies' room and reveals that Crystal is seeing Buck. Although Sylvia does not believe her, Dolly soon sweeps in and confirms the news. As Buck begins his tune on stage, Sylvia drags Crystal into the ladies' room, followed by Kay, Dolly, Gloria, and Amanda. Kay tries to prevent a fistfight between Sylvia and Crystal, which ends when Dolly threatens to print a story about the affair, which will ruin Crystal's chances of receiving alimony from Stephen. After the Countess enters to report that Buck is a huge hit, Crystal retorts that she will elope with Buck and then tells Stephen that she is leaving him. When she informs Buck of her decision, however, he announces that he has no intention of marrying her. Kay spots Stephen sitting alone, and when she calls him over, he is overjoyed finally to sweep her into his arms and onto the dance floor. The first article I'm going to read from is a Cosmopolitan article called On Location with the Opposite Sex by John Whitcomb, and this was published in October 1956, and it is a bit lengthy, and less review but more, well, literally, what's going on as they are shooting. Joan Collins fidgeted. "My wig itches," she complained. "Nobody likes my hair, so I have to wear this all through the film." We were having lunch in MGM's commissary along with Dolores Gray and my publicity department escort, Emily Torchia. Joan and Dolores were working on a new film version of The Women, now retitled The Opposite Sex, and I had been invited to the studio to watch them tackle a new version of Crystal's famous bathtub scene. After lunch, we went over to the big soundstage where the pictures sets were standing. The actresses disappeared into their dressing rooms for makeup, and Emily showed me the opulent bathroom where the afternoon shooting will take place. The tub was pink, translucent, and enormous, actually made of an ingenious plastic devised by technician Henry Grutert and first used for palace walls in Kismet. It looked like alabaster and was full of snowy bubbles. Then we have a subsection, The Lady and the Tub. Hope Joan doesn't have any trouble today, Emily said. She's allergic to something in those suds. Makes her break out. Between that wig and the bathwater, she's really suffering. Joe Pasternak, the picture's producer, came over and I was introduced. Read my book yet, he asked. I said I hadn't. What is going on? His face clouded 1/8 of a degree. Emily said she'd see that I got a copy. Easy the hard way. G.P. Putnam Sons. When we got back to her office in the publicity department, and Mr. Pasternak looked happier. By this time, the director, David Miller, had arrived, and workmen were swarming over the tub, turning valves that shot compressed air into the bottom. Walter Pidgeon wandered in from another stage, looking for a favorite mechanic to repair his cigarette lighter. A magazine photographer checked his focus. The crowd became so thick it was now impossible to see the tub. And when Joan arrived to start work, she had rehearsed a speech twice for the sound man before I caught a glimpse of her. Occasionally, she stood up for the ministrations of Frank Prohoda, her makeup man. I could see that she was wearing flesh-colored trunks and a brassiere, and I noticed, too, that the still cameraman had stopped taking pictures. Orders from the front office, as it turned out, no shots of Miss Collins out of her bubbles. After perhaps 30 or 40 minutes, during which Joan made several takes with the child actress Sandy Deschert, a wail was heard from the tub. Then weeping, Miss Collins was rising from her bath, legs red and swollen. Several people wrapped her in a towel, and there was a brief conference with the studio doctor. A flying wedge in football formation, oh my word, another sports metaphor, rushed the lady to her dressing room, and an assistant director announced over loudspeakers that the operations would be suspended for an hour. When the period was over, Miss Collins was popped right back into her tub, this time wearing rubber pants, which did no good, and neither did a coating of grease, which was tried later. Timeout is too expensive on pictures with a $16 to, and I actually can't read this, it could be $600 or $900 daily overhead. I made a date with the projection room to see a print of the women for purposes of comparison. I must have had my head in a barrel in 1939 because I had seen it only as a New York stage play, directed by George Cukor and featuring an all-woman cast. The movie created a big stir and made lots of money. Also, I was interested because David Miller had forbidden the new lineup of June Allison, Joan Collins, Dolores Gray, Ann Sheridan, Joan Blondell, Ann Miller, Agnes Moorehead, and Barbara Jo Allen to see it. His new cast would be without influence from the past. New subsection, Women, Then and Now. The next afternoon, while Joan Collins was still fighting the bubbles in her bath, I spent a fascinating hour and a half in projection room B looking at the women. Hour and a half? What happened to the last 45 minutes? Miller needn't have worried. 17 years ago, I discovered styles and acting were almost as antique as the quality of the soundtrack. Good heavens. The ladies all seemed to have gravel in their throats. Wow. And the extravagant fashions they wore, executed by the incomparable Adrian, whose reputation soared to the top along with Greta Garbo's, well, they were just plain funny. Miss Russell, playing Sylvia, chewed scenery and threw her eyebrows around like an apprentice in summer stock. Norma Shearer looked and sounded dowdy, making me wonder what I ever saw in her. Of the whole crowd, only Joan Fontaine and Paulette Goddard looked familiar and believable. Saddened by the cruelty of time, I hardly noticed when the film ended. Well, because he didn't even watch the whole thing. The projectionist threw a switch and the screen widened out into CinemaScope and Eastman Color, and I looked at a 3-minute scene from the new film, an episode which had been completed a few days before. The setting was a replica of the Restaurant 21 in New York, and in the foreground, Ann Sheridan, Dolores Gray, Joan Blondell, and June Allison were seated at lunch. Their voices were crisp and clear, good presence, the sound engineers call it. The Helen Rose costumes were in quiet good taste, and the ladies behaved like people you've met and liked before. The dialogue by Faye and Michael Kanin went about like this. Barbara Jo Allen in the role of woman gossip columnist. Well, what are you four conspiring about? Anything unfit to print? Allison. Not today, Dolly. Allen, oh you. If I had to depend on any dirt about you for a living, I'd starve to death. Allison. I may surprise you someday and run off with the milkman. Allen, you're not the type. Looking over at Blondell, who is gorging on a banana split. Now with Edith, I could believe it. Mother of seven leaves lawyer for milkman, noticing Blondell's maternity dress. Edith Potter, not again. Blondell, complacently. Mother of eight in January, gray. Really, it's getting monotonous watching you eat for two all the time. Grimly chews her forkful of grass. Banana splits with me on watercress. Later on, in the same scene, Sheridan remarks, you just can't stand Kay's happiness, can you, Sylvia? It gets you down. Gray, that's ridiculous. Why should it? Sheridan, because she has the grace to be what she is. Gray, which is what? Sheridan, a woman. Gray, and what are we? Sheridan, females. The lost sex. Substituting fashion for passion and the analyst couch for the double bed. This gives you a rough idea of how Claire Booth Luce's acid story of feminine venom has been adapted for 1957. But the new version has one important addition. Joe Pasternak says, quote, a whole film about women with nothing but women was a stunt. Here we've added men, which is what the opposite sex is mainly interested in. Leslie Nielsen plays the strained husband, and Jeff Richards is the Nevada cowboy with the bulging libido and the boogie guitar. Come over to the back lot tomorrow. Jeff and June are doing a canoe scene you might like to watch, end quote. You know what? I don't like to watch that scene. Another addition is music. While not exactly a musical, the opposite sex says Pasternak is a comedy with music. Subsection, paddling a stubborn canoe. MGM's back lot is a wooded tract with lots of elbow room and a lake. June Allison, in riding pants and a suede jacket, was standing on a grassy bank with Jeff Richards in Buck's horse wrangler outfit. The scene, occupying less than a page of script, took all afternoon to film. The director, David Miller, a blue-eyed blonde with a slight build, has a reputation as a perfectionist, is a stickler for quiet, and has been known to throw a fit until he gets it. On this sunny afternoon, the chief offenders were jet planes overhead. Noises can be removed from film in the sound laboratory in a process called looping. Difficulties began when Jeff Richards dashed over behind some bushes and pulled out a canoe, which he had to help June Allison into, board himself, and paddled directly away from the camera. The canoe refused to go in the right direction, and in the end, some prop men attached underwater wires to the bow and towed it away while Richards pretended to paddle. Between scenes, Allison gets her hair brushed, got her face fixed by Stanley Smith, her makeup expert, and kept up a running fire of wisecracks with the camera crew. One gag went like this. Allison would pout and say, if you're not good to me, I'll go back to, and the crew would shout, Columbia, we know, and Allison would finish, where I was happy. This is a local joke. Allison happens to be the current top dough queen on the MGM lot. Her salary for opposite sex was $3,000 a day on a 12-week guarantee, which works out to around $200,000 for her services. While crew members worked on the lights, more visitors ambled over for a look. A young assistant producer on the opposite sex set became confidential about actors. He said, quote, I have a low opinion of actors. They're all spoiled children with oversized egos, end quote. He introduced me to one of the electricians, saying, quote, now here's a real celebrity. This is the guy who taped back Clark Gable's ears for a crucial test when Gable was working for $300 a week, end quote. New subsection, costumes worth coveting. Two wardrobe women went up to June and fingered her jacket. Exquisite. I love these clothes, Miss Allison said. Helen Rose is just terrific. You should see the red satin job I get gussied up in later on. My children will flip. By the way, we're having big arguments at home these days. You know me, no voice at all, but the children like my records better than Dick's. Isn't that a panic? And the other day they gave me the ultimate compliment. Mommy, you sing better than Doris Day. How's that for loyalty? You know, Dick's only been on the set here to see me once. He ran smack into Joan Blondell and vanished. That's the end of her quotation. The pals live in the kind of farmhouse that any millionaire might build if he were a farmer. Perched in the slopes above Manville Canyon, the 50-acre estate is approached by a winding road that rises through the wooded hills and curves around a lake mirroring the main house. Originally built by an MGM executive, the structure is of stone with shutters at the windows and huge trees lining the paved drive. It was dusk when I arrived for cocktails, and Dick was mixing drinks in the bar off the pine-paneled living room. June came in and sat down to play with the children on a big red sofa. The little girl, about eight, was poised. The boy, who managed to resemble both his father and mother, was busy juggling two pistols out of holsters in his belt in the manner of all five-year-olds. The family was looking forward to Munich, where June was starting a picture at the conclusion of The Opposite Sex, and Dick said he planned to make some TV films in Europe at the same time. The conversation left foreign travel and went to diets. Dick was dieting. June never has to. Then to Ed Murrow, person to person, had visited the palace shortly before, and the house had yet to recover from the uproar. June said, quote, "The children were blinded by the lights, and they never did find out where Mr. Murrow was. They thought he was in the loudspeakers, but guess who got all the fan mail? My son, the little scene stealer," end quote. New subsection, a seven-car family. In contrast to the palace showplace, Dolores Gray's hilltop hacienda is compact and modest. Halfway up the winding road off Benedict Canyon, leading to Elizabeth Taylor's place at the top, Dolores hangs her hat in a flower-decked modern house built on a shelf overlooking Cary Grant's house below. He's never home, apparently, to her. The view from her swimming pool at night is well worth the zigzag trip up the mountain. Besides French poodles, she has five silver miniatures. Dolores is fond of cars, and the paved courtyard next to the pool barely holds her collection. The fleet currently consists of a black Jaguar, a white Jaguar, a pink Ford, a red and white Chevrolet, a gray Delahaye bought on impulse one day out of a show window on the Champs-Élysées, a white Corvette, and turquoise Thunderbird. On the evening I visited the Grays, Dolores' mother, Barbara, had just finished pasting rhinestones on the rumps of some Chinese horses, which marched majestically across one wall of the Hawaiian-decorated living room. The whole Gray family is cheerfully fond of do-it-yourself. Barbara plans the decor, and Dolores and her brother spray paint, repot plants, and build retaining walls with unusual abandon. I told Dolores I had trouble picturing her troweling cement. She promptly took me on a detailed tour saying, "I built that wall from here to here, so help me." The Gray reputation began with the 3 years London spent worshipping Dolores as the star of Annie Get Your Gun. A smash hit as a singer in England, she repeated her success in musical shows in New York. She sang in two Metro pictures, It's Always Fair Weather and Kismet, but her role as Sylvia in The Opposite Sex is strictly a spoken one. "Everybody gets to sing but me," she laments, "but the gowns I wear make up for it. I just drip diamonds." Subsection, Siren with a Sweet Voice. Joan Collins, a slender, green-eyed English brunette who has mastered American without a trace of accent, has difficulty with her sweet, cool voice in making Crystal sound sufficiently predatory. Miller said, "We'll loop her speeches until we get it." On the evening I called at her apartment on Olive Street, shooting at the studio kept her late, and Emily Torchia and I waited for an hour on the long flight of steps leading up the hill to Joan's door. She arrived breathless in shirt and slacks, her black hair tied in a ponytail with a ribbon. When we had climbed to the tiny two-bedroom apartment, Joan immediately sank down on a sofa and kicked off her shoes. "Tub scene's over, thank heaven," she announced. "Never thought I'd live through it. That gook made me break out all over. I've never been so miserable. But I'm not through with the wig," she sighed. "Anyone for a drink?" she asked. "I'm too tired to pour." The shop talk got around to the famous fight scene in which the injured wife socks Joan, the other woman. It had been filmed early in production, Emily told me, and not without a certain amount of directorial guile. To go back to the beginning, the publicity department at Metro remembered the legendary feuds and battles on the set of The Women, and had been looking forward to a similar collection of newsworthy items from the new film. My gosh, just let the people be. Here were dames, strong personalities, and the material for mayhem. To everyone's surprise, all the new girls turned out to be cordial chums. They boosted each other in private and praised each other on the set. On the day of the fight scene, the crowd was larger than usual, and the reporters were hoping for fireworks. "It wasn't that way at all," Joan said, giggling. "David came to me and coached me on how to dodge the blow, and said June had instructions to pull her punch. Then he went to June, told her they were going to use the first take, and to let me have it with all she had. Well, I forgot to duck. June socked me so hard she gave me a black eye, knocked me out cold. Then she burst into tears and ran away to her dressing room. I was a long time coming too. Then I cried and cried. Then June and I cried together." Subsection, Anne Sheridan, a changed girl. And this is the final section. The story at Anne Sheridan's house is a ghost. Not long ago, Anne bought a big Mediterranean-style stucco place in the San Fernando Valley because she liked the gardens. The flowers were handsome, and it was a perfect playground for 21 Sheridan poodles. The house had been built by a millionaire for a second wife, a Chinese girl who died soon after they came there to live. Now, on calm nights, the faint sound of clogs can be heard tap-tapping on the garden paths, and when the doors opening on the garden are locked at night, they are always open in the morning. Although she was not working that day, Anne came down to the studio to have lunch with me. She was carrying a couple of Albert Schweitzer's books under her arm. "He fits in with my mood these days," she explained. "I'm a changed girl. I have inner peace and no conflicts. Sorry I didn't get with it until I was 35. And even now I'm not exactly sure what happened, but it's great." Her voice is deep and resonant, and even without makeup, Anne Sheridan is striking, with big hazel eyes and red gold hair. The Sheridan voice narrates the opposite sex and presents a well-bred contrast to the harpy tones of Miss Luce's fictional females. Meanwhile, with the finish of the filming in sight, MGM's press department is still wondering what happened to all the lively battle yarns they were counting on. Except for the Collins black eye and the refusal of Miss Ann Miller to fight at all, they used a double, nothing really spicy has turned up. The current crop of actresses is disappointingly polite during business hours. What is happening? This is honestly the deal with men, I just have to say. It's like, why are you looking for drama when there's no need for it? That's messed up. It really is. In the opposite sex, all the kicking, biting, and scratching will be on the screen. The end. And I did, within that, find a very interesting ad. Oh boy, for Zonite. And I love this ad because how many people actually know what a douche is? So this quote is, "I learned this is no secret, but a fact of life," says Mrs. Catherine Russo, who now uses Zonite to douche. "It is safe. Married women, brides, and brides-to-be often wonder about douching for feminine hygiene. Eventually, they discover, as did Mrs. Russo, that it's an important fact of life to follow the proper method of douching with a fountain syringe using an effective yet safe solution like Zonite. It is effective. No other type liquid antiseptic germicide for the douche of all those tested is so powerfully effective yet so safe to body tissues as Zonite. It is healthful. Zonite completely deodorizes, promptly washes away germs and odor-causing waste substances. A nurse once advised Mrs. Russo that if any abnormal condition exists, she should see her doctor. She said he would probably recommend that she continue to use Zonite." And I like how the doctor is assumed to be male. "It is dainty. You too can be one of the modern women who welcome the peace of mind and daintiness that Zonite gives them after monthly periods and other times." Do you know what those other times are? It's the sexy times, because the penis brings another biome into the, you know. "You can use Zonite as directed as often as needed without the slightest risk of injury. Costs only pennies per douche." So, very interesting. I've never seen a douche ad, but you know what? It's cosmopolitan. It's Cosmo. Okay, so that was, you know, on the set. So these are some reviews. We have a review from Variety, published on the 19th of September, 1956. "The Opposite Sex, high-powered remake with music of The Women, 1939 pick hit. Strong cast names, strong B-O-Biz. The female of the species is more deadly than the male, a fact that the opposite sex again emphasizes for the odd amusement of the male viewer and the discomfort of some distaff lookers. As a remake with music of Clare Booth's feline comedy The Women, first screened by Metro in 1939, it's high-powered entertainment with a name cast and a strong box office potential. The mixture of marriage and morals, songs and satire under Joe Pasternak's top-notch production supervision plays with a pleasing frothy glibness as the femmes test their claws on each other and on their men. Scripting by Faye and Michael Kanin is a slick surface analysis of gals who are consistently inconsistent, made entertaining viewing by plenty and spicy dialogue, beautiful settings and costumes, good times, good tunes, and first-rate directorial pacing by David Miller. June Allison, who hasn't sung in picks for quite a few years, turns on the vocalistics pleasantly, as the girl who almost loses her man to a sex pod enacted by Joan Collins before she decides to become a feline femme herself. Young Man with the Horn, done with Harry James, and A Perfect Love both treat the ear via her slightly hoarse voice. For a spectacular production number, she appears with a male group in Now Baby Now. A calypso note is sounded in another production piece, Dare's Yellow Gold on de Trees. Do what? That was not the title, but okay. featuring. If that is the title, then there was some major appropriation and racism going on there, and I did not catch it. Hmm. Okay. Featuring Ms. Collins and dancers. Guest stars Dick Shawn and Jim Bacchus act out the comedic title tune about a psychiatrist's couch cluttered with dames for a good laugh spot. The big musical score, though, is Rock and Roll Tumbleweed, put over with a bang by Jeff Richards, backed by Art Mooney. New tunes are by Nicholas Brodsky and Sammy Kahn, with Robert Sidney staging the production numbers. In addition to the tune duties, Miss Allison clicks as the ever-loving wife who runs off to Reno when hubby Leslie Nielsen gets trapped by Miss Collins, and then learns that if she wants her man back, she must adopt the predatory methods of her Park Avenue sisters under the skin. She gets him in an expose of feline tricks of the trade that gain in mirth under such instructors as Dolores Gray, a dame who loses Bill Goodwin to the non-dancing but potent Ann Miller, Ann Sheridan, writer who doesn't have a man but knows all about them, Agnes Moorehead, a joy as the much married and unmarried Reno visitor, Charlotte Greenwood, a click as a proprietor of a haven for twixt and between women, and Joan Blondell, delightful as a girl who thinks marriage consists of babies and proves it almost every year. Miss Collins makes a man wonder why Nielsen took so long to get caught in her web. While it's a femme show, males are still a necessary part if the wheels of love are to go round. Ably furnishing reason for their presence are Nielsen, Jeff Richards, and such others trapped in the battle of the sexes as Sam Levine, Bill Goodwin, and Jonathan Hole. Picture is a particularly happy vehicle for Richards playing the bashfully amorous cowpoke at Miss Greenwood's divorcee haven. He wraps up the character in solid style. Sandy Desher does well as a moppet, and there's a biting satire of a composite femme columnist by Barbara Jo Allen. Alice Pierce, a gossipy manicurist, Carolyn Jones, and others contribute to the fun. The CinemaScope photography in Metrocolor by Robert Bronner is one of the technical pluses, as is the art direction, set decorations, costuming by Helen Rose, and special effects. George Stoll gives the music excellent supervision. Brog. The next review is from the New York Times, published 16th of November, 1956. Although Claire Booth's The Women was staged about 20 years ago and Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer filmed it in 1939, it has aged gracefully, to judge by The Opposite Sex, the remake that arrived at the Capitol yesterday. Most of Miss Booth's comedy drama still drips vitriol, and the fangs and claws of its decorative vixens are almost as terrifying as they were two decades ago. The venomous mixture of deadly females versus deadlier females, sharp dialogue and songs, is a surface inspection of a segment of Manhattan society rather than the deep dissection it once was. One might not want to live in this plush jungle, but the principals, who keep the catfights going briskly, make it an interesting place to visit. Although some aspects of the original investigation of the well-endowed Park Avenue Broadway echelon have changed, The Women basically is still the story of the jaded, frenetic women, whose meat is gossip and whose wine is divorce talk. It is still the soigné tale of Kay Hilliard, former singer whose 10-year marriage to play producer Stephen Hilliard is the envy of one of her malicious, well-heeled friends. The pointed chatter of beauty salons and bistros that eventually leads to the wreck of the marriage, as well as several others, is still highlighted by some bitter satire. Although our heroine's happy home life finally is restored, it is, as has been noted, a feline carnival for the ladies before the villainesses get their comeuppances. Speaking of the ladies, it might be added that it is this coroner's opinion that the lush wardrobes, enhanced by excellent color photography provided for this covey of dames, is enough to drive distiff viewers to distraction. Although the addition of five new songs by the team of Nicholas Brodsky and Sammy Kahn would seem out of place in a comedy of manners and mores, most of them are fitted neatly into the plot. June Allison, who does an excellent job as Indomitable Kay, gives a good, throaty rendition of Now Baby Now. Joan Collins' performance as the two-timing chorus girl who snatched as Miss Allison's husband is eye-filling but heartily inspired. Dolores Gray as the blonde gossip monger who loses her mate to Ann Miller, Ann Sheridan as a sympathetic, unattached writer who knows all about the opposite sex, Joan Blondell in a brief role as the gentle matron who is making a career of motherhood, and Agnes Moorehead as a brassy, much-married countess lend spice to the palaver and punch to the battles. The men, including Jeff Richards as a handsome Reno cowpoke for whom the Mrs. Gray and Collins fall, Leslie Nielsen as Miss Allison's husband, and Sam Levine as her agent, try desperately to color comparatively pallid assignments. There's no point in underestimating them. Despite commendable stints by producer Joe Pasternak and director David Miller, the ladies dominate the opposite sex. It should be a treat for them. And then finally, from Time Magazine, published on the 5th of November in 1956, The Opposite Sex, MGM, is one of Hollywood's weirder experiments with taste. The effect, in this case, roughly resembling a dill pickle smothered with whipped cream. The picture is based on playwright Claire Booth Luce's 1936 play, The Women. The play was made into a picture in 1939, and audiences of that time enjoyed the satirical thrusts and hair-pulling matches. In this version, however, producer Joe Pasternak has sugared everything up with pretty metro color, with June Allison, who plays the spirited heroine, as a teary little dearie, and with a batch of sentimental tunes. Worse still, the Faye and Michael Kanin script carelessly tosses away one of the play's best ideas. There are men in the picture. In the play, men never appeared. It was as if the world were one vast, closed powder room. And though the scriptwriters have kept the play's plain plot, gossip wrecks marriage, husband marries gold digger, wife gets him back, they have jazzed it up with plenty of new wisecracks, some of them acute, others merely cute. So even though it seems like, again, the majority of these reviews, probably all of them, were written by men, and definitely that one I would call the Variety reviewer a sexist, the other two from New York Times and New York Magazine don't think as highly of this adaptation when compared to the previous. I'm going to take a break, and when I return, I'm going to be joined by a special guest again in looking at this film and answering that age-old question of whether it's feminist or misogynist.
I am vengeance. I am the knight. I am Batman.
You need to take out the trash.
I don't have time for that now. We have two podcasts I have to create a new promo for.
What? Both JLUcast and Supermates?
Yes. JLUcast, where you and I discussed the Justice League and Justice League Unlimited animated series from Bruce Timm and Company.
And Supermates, our original show where we talk about all sorts of geeky stuff, including our annual House of Frankenstein series on classic horror films. Yeah.
That's it. But how do we combine this into one promo?
I have no idea, but it sounds like we're doing our original Supermates promo all over again.
I kind of think we are, but hey, other folks kind of aped it, so it must have worked.
Well, why don't you get to work taking out the trash, and I'll finish up.
Great.
So join us, Cindy.
And Chris.
On JLUcast and Supermates, both proudly part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, found at fireandwaterpodcast.com and on iTunes.
Well, welcome back. Now, joining me for this half is a friend of mine, maybe a dear friend. Let's not be too hasty in saying that, though. He goes by many names, some of which only I call him, but we'll just be serious on this one and say welcome to the show again, actually. Season 2 is on season 1. Harry Shute.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
Now, first things first, how do you identify?
As a male.
Okay. Do you feel out of place on this show right now?
Out of place, claustrophobic, okay. Hemmed in,
okay.
Anxious.
Some discomfiture?
Very, very much so.
Okay.
Yes.
That is as it should be, since, of course, this season is all about the women, and men really don't belong anywhere. But the reason why I have you on this show is because men have wormed their way into this particular film.
Mm-hmm.
Why? What is your background? Why would I bring you on for this particular episode, do you think, besides your identification?
I'm a self-professed expert in film. I've seen over 2 dozen of them.
Okay. 2 dozen, man. That doesn't make you an expert. I don't know what does.
Well, this would be the 25th, I suppose. I mean, this was a question that I wanted to pose to you. Why on earth have you dragged me here?
Why on earth? Yes. Well, you would say that I hoodwinked you into watching this film. I would say that it was a really kind gesture to invite you onto this particular show. Well, the reason I think I even had said something way back, like several months ago, and said, you know, I thought about inviting you on the show, but then I realized I didn't want any men on this particular season. Do you remember this conversation?
I will say yes.
Okay. He doesn't remember me. Did I tell him? But then you said, but you already did, because I had forgotten that, of course, you were on the Jane episode of that.
Yes.
And so I was going through, and I knew I kept hounding the good Professor Coca to come on, and so she finally did. And then I thought, well, you know, if I were to have a man on, it would be for this movie, because I know that there are men in this film. And because we often view films either together or separately and then come together and really hash it out and never agree on anything, with very few exceptions, I thought that it would be very interesting to have you on here. So, of course, I asked, do you want to see a movie with me? And you thought I was tricking you, because Babylon has been the joke movie that I keep saying, like, we should watch Babylon together so I don't have to suffer through 3 hours alone. So you thought it was Babylon. I said, it's not Babylon, but I won't tell you what it is. And then you agreed, and I said, no take backs. And you said, no take backs. And so here we are. For good or for ill. Is that how you remember it?
Yeah, I mean, we have the text evidence, of course, that we could look at. Yeah, no take backs is probably a red flag that I should have respected. But, you know, I figured, how bad could it be? And I think I'm still sort of not sure what your reaction to the film was based on how you were sort of communicating it to me. And this has been like a mental puzzle that I've been sort of playing with over the past week or so.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. So would you say that I gaslit you a bit?
I just say, as usual, you've intrigued me with yet another game.
I'm glad to hear it. Now, to be genuine for a moment, because you and I know that we're not very genuine in this particular relationship, I do, while I disagree a lot with what you say and how you abuse the English language, I do respect how much care and attention you put into your analyses that go up on your website. So that was another reason why I wanted you to examine this film with me.
Thank you. That's very nice.
You're welcome. What is that website for the people at home?
That would be witheyeseast.com.
There you go. And I'll give you some time. So before we unlock this puzzle, what is your history with this film? This film, of course, being The Opposite Sex.
I had never heard of this movie before. And in fact, when I went to look for it, I could not immediately find it. Instead, thinking it might have been a movie called The Opposite of Sex, about a 16-year-old who has some sort of relationship with a gay brother. I don't know. That was very confusing.
Yes, that sounds like a train wreck that we're going to have, with starring Christina Ricci,
yes.
That we're going to have to view at some point. Mm-hmm. And my history with this is my first viewing of it. I did not know of it. I had only known of the two major adaptations of this particular play, obviously being thrown off by this particular title, which we will come to. So both of us are coming in not having any relationship with this film. So we're both on the same thing. And now the next important question is, did you like this film?
Maybe I should answer the same way I did for Jane. No.
No. Well, I am not too surprised that you didn't like it. As I was watching it, I was thinking to myself, how is Harry reacting? And even this morning, I sent you a text and asked, did you survive? Using, you know, survive as the term. I will agree with you and say that I also did not care for it. I think there are some interesting and entertaining moments, but for me, I felt like there was an extreme lack of substance to it, and it just ignores like many important themes and moments of the play. So I just felt like they took what the play was and the 1939 version and decided to, I don't know, I guess really just make it 50s and try to awe with the Technicolor and everything and make it a musical, and it lost something for me. So I did not care for it. It was interesting, to be sure, and I could catch some fleeting moments of the play, but there are a lot of changes, which I don't want to go. I mean, inevitably, they will come up, but I won't just, like, sit here and talk about every single thing that is different, because there's just too much. Okay. So I, of course, we have a rubric, and at times in the rubric, I will say a name, like Mary Haynes, for instance, and then tell you what the name of the actual character is in the film. So even though it's the Mary Haynes in the play, for example, the film, her name is Kay Hilliard, so just be aware that I'll be talking, saying multiple names. At one point, I'll probably get sick of it and just say the name of the person in the film. And then with this, I have so many questions, more than I had for The Professor, just because that film, 1939, was so closely related to the play that I already did a deep dive and analyzed that play. But here it's like we're watching something new and from scratch. So this will be very interesting to talk about. So this is also interesting because I do have a male perspective on there. So while I'm looking at it from one vantage point, he's looking at it from a different viewpoint. And as always throughout this season, the big question is whether this film is sexist / misogynist or is it feminist? And I'll be asking that throughout as well. So to begin with a nice little softball question, how do you feel like the title, The Opposite Sex, sets the tone for the film compared to the original title of The Women? Does it change anything for you?
Oh, man. The softball question is already up.
Well, let's begin at the beginning. Maybe it wasn't a softball question then.
I mean, I guess it has kind of an effect like the movie title Parasite, where it has that sort of double meaning, because in this case, it literally does, if you want to consider that there are only two sexes, which obviously isn't the case. But if you want to have an opposite, then I suppose you have to assume that. And in this case, it's like, well, if I'm a male viewer, then the opposite sex is women. If I'm a female viewer, then the opposite sex is men. And so this is going to be about relationships, I suppose, inherently in perspective. So I guess in that way, it has more meaning, but The Women, I think, is a lot more specific. I mean, it's hard to be specific with a title like that, but I suppose relatively. So it's like, you know, this is in the 1930s. This is called The Women. It's about female experiences specifically. So I suppose that would be maybe the difference.
Yeah, whenever I see the word sex, depending on context, I think, well, we know that it does depend on context and how it is being used, but I feel like that's always like a really big flag kind of in your face. Like even as a Latin teacher, sex is six in Latin, and I always have like giggling, you know, prepubescent or pubescent teenagers giggling at it. And so I feel like there is something in here, like they're trying to get your attention very quickly by using that rather than the women. It's interesting the point you made about depending on what your identification is, you're going to have a different viewpoint of what the opposite sex is to you. But I feel like because it's based off of the women and it's intended to mean the women, then it's like, oh, the audience is male and it's from the male gaze. Because I feel like the assumption is it's the opposite to the male identity, which is interesting. Which again, you know, the whole play is originally, right? There aren't any men, but men are everywhere in the play. And so in the film, there are men, which is a bit weird, but you know, you have all these women, but again, it's how they're relating to men. It's just this time your imagination doesn't have to work because they're also there. Also, they had a song. So I don't know which came first, the song or the title. So they could have been working hand in hand. But yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's just not as powerful to me as The Women. And I feel like The Women is simplistic, but once you are viewing or reading the play, it becomes all the more powerful. But just the opposite sex just doesn't seem as powerful to me without the glaring sex word that's right there, because it is very much about sex in this particular film.
Seeking stones as bright as stars that glimmer.
Why do little silkworms go about their business?
To make my lady's limbs just shimmer. Why do those talented Parisian gents rack their brains concocting fragrant scents?
Oh, why do minks?
Yes, why do minks?
Willingly let themselves get trapped. The answer is not too complex. The answer is
the opposite sex. Why do men who should know better gape at a well-filled sweater? What's there about it that keeps them craning their necks? The answer is the opposite sex. Now to explore the topic, take matters philanthropic. What keeps them writing those non-deductible checks? Give up. The answer is the opposite sex. There are no substitutes for this original thrill. There is no chemistry can ever replace it, friends. Face it, friends. Folks who were once frustrated, what gets them all elated? It's very simple, although it may sound complex. It means that they've uncovered it, come to and discovered that wonderful bit called the opposite sex.
So we begin with, and you and I have talked about this because I've been watching Station 19 and Grey's Anatomy used to do this. Station 19 doesn't do it anymore, but there is narration that begins by Ms. Amanda Penrose, who is very much the Nancy character from the play, the writer. Her part here is huge. What do you think about having a narration? It doesn't continue the entire way. It has kind of a, let's look at all these women who can afford to be on Park Avenue or was it Fifth Avenue are shopping, and the ones who can't, like, ride in a bus looking at the women who can't. So it's clearly the haves and the have-nots. And then she introduces herself and Sylvia and maybe Kay, and then it stops. There's no further narration. What do you think about using this as a device, and that it doesn't continue throughout the rest of the film?
That whenever that happens, it always feels like kind of a mistake. And I think that the opening scenes of this movie gave me the really a wrong impression. It was a very bad introduction, because I was kind of adrift for a lot of it. And I realized it was because I didn't know immediately who the main character was.
Yeah.
Because obviously you have this Penrose character narrating, and then the narration stops. And, oh, okay, here's this Kay character. She must be the one from the descriptions who is the happily married singer. And a lot of the language of the voiceover is interesting, too. It's sort of... like, you know, oh, the female of the species, sometimes livelier than the male, always deadlier. Like, it just didn't, I don't know. I can't buy that kind of thing, I guess.
Do you think that's coming from her as a writer?
Oh, yeah, maybe. That would make sense. But then I suppose, and this, I think this is going to be a recurring theme, you would need some of that in the actual text of the film, that, like, you know, you're a writer, maybe you're a little bit pompous.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah, I feel like we see it a couple times. You know, she and Amanda, a.k.a. Nancy, and Sylvia, a.k.a. Sylvia, get into it. Like, they clearly do not like each other. And so they do talk about that at that one scene in the restaurant, I guess the first time that we see Kay. And then later on when when Kay is talking about Stephen cheating on her, Amanda is saying things like, this, you know, it happens all the time. I write about it all the time as well. So there are only, like, those subtle nods to that. But, yeah, it's almost like she treats I guess she talks about that, doesn't she? They do pull that line from the play about, you know, Mary is a, can't remember what they called her, but then Sylvia says, well, what are we? And she says, the female. It's yeah. different. And normally she refers to her as a frozen asset, but she does not do that in this particular adaptation. But I guess maybe she's just looking at it clinically and almost like a documentary of like, look at these women. But you're right that I too is like, oh, is Amanda supposed to be Mary Haynes? The fact that we're following her through and everything? Yes. I don't know. I feel like we lost a little bit something from the original because the beginning is all about seeing these working class women and how they're relating to the upper class women and seeing them complain and everything. And then we zone in on Olga and Sylvia. And I feel like we lose that a little bit because we're following this upper class woman as she's making her way to another upper class woman. So you kind of leave out the working class.
I think the it was a difference between women and females, which is interesting. And
differences.
It was also a little bit, not disorienting, but I guess confusing, because she, when she's talking to Sylvia, who's having the manicure or something done at the spa, she says, like, oh, my friend, quote unquote, and then they sort of get into it, and you're like, oh, okay, well, so this is sort of their relationship. They're not really friends.
Yeah.
But then they're kind of, like, hanging out a lot over the course of the movie, so I was like, oh, so they are friends. That was a little bit interesting.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of social circles.
Yeah.
Because Amanda is, as we'll see throughout the entire film, is really close with Mary. Ugh! Is really close with Kay.
Yeah.
So I think because Kay is still, quote unquote, friends with Sylvia, I don't know that she's, I'm still missing it if she's cousins with Sylvia in this particular adaptation. But I think like it's almost as one of those situations of you have to kind of suck it up to be with someone you don't like in order to be with someone that you do if there's like a group outing.
Oh, man.
Plus they're all in this kind of clique, right?
So yeah.
It's like high school as well. It's like, well, you know, some of these people are going to like each other and some of them are not.
Right. And so I suppose that's where the economic brackets would really play in, is that you're sort of stuck with these people because you're here, and that's why competition is so fierce.
Yeah. Which is interesting because you can only, you know, I wonder what would happen if somebody lost their fortune, if they would get kicked out of that circle.
Right.
Because Crystal makes her fortune by marrying Steven, but she, because she has alienated other people, like Kay's never going to let her in, and then the people that are devoted to Kay are never going to allow her in there. But that's why Sylvia is able to sort of fracture off from that circle and be friends with Crystal. But Crystal had to lift herself up in order to do that, because Sylvia is never going to stoop to that particular socioeconomic class.
Mm-hmm. And as we'll also see with Crystal, it might be a matter of that position, or her position, makes her vulnerable to her own individual flaws being an actual problem for other people,
right.
as we'll find out. But the opening scenes where Nancy is moving across the street, I suppose, I don't really remember it. It does introduce us to the production design and the world of the movie, which I think are probably the strongest elements. And, of course, the Technicolor.
Yep.
I'm a huge fan of the show Mad Men, but in 7 seasons, I think there was one exterior shot of 1960s Manhattan. So I do like to see, in this case, 1956 New York. And just the whole place is so alien. Like, the costumes, they're so over-designed. They look like a Dune miniseries. And even just the first building they're in, the spa, like, it isn't readily identifiable as like what we would think of as a spa these days. Like, it's an office building where if you want to go from the manicure place to the bath, you kind of go through these like narrow corridors that don't feel like they're for customers. So it's just like, even just the spaces themselves are just very interesting to look at.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, a lot of this, which comes from the previous version as well, you know, the fashion and the styles and being over the top, obviously, but only if you're upper class. And then if you're not, your over the topness happens in the show, where we do get quite a number of show tunes and numbers throughout this. But yeah, I agree with you. I think there are, I would say the majority of outfits in the 39 version. There are some in this that I really can't stand. I can't stand Kay's hat in the first scene. I just don't like it for whatever reason. But her red dress at the end is amazing. There are some other outfits. Like, I feel like all of her outfits are pretty good. Like, during the anniversary party, I really liked that beige outfit, but it had kind of glitter diamonds. This is not my world. I can only look at it and comment positively on it. And then some of the things. And Amanda also, I also liked what Amanda was wearing throughout. But I feel like, yeah, the Technicolor, which is also something that's just very shocking, which is interesting. The 39 had that 5-minute interlude of a fashion show, and that was in color. And then here we have it all. I think it was well used, you know, especially with those show numbers that they had. But just these colors that are bright and amazing and really, yeah, brings to life everything. We don't get too many exterior shots, do we, besides that initial street scene. Maybe that party that seemed to be out on somebody's lawn, but everything else. And then I think when Kay leaves the theater and Stephen rushes after her, but everything else seems to be more or less an interior shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you liked the world building.
I think I made a specific note about the word world building. I like how the movie looks, and I, for whatever reason, I just kind of like movies in the 1950s and I like watching them, even though I don't end up liking them a whole lot. I just read an article today about Invaders from Mars, which I think was in the 1950s. I mean, it must have been. But they were talking about it as if it was a different movie than the one I had seen. Like, oh, this was, you know, the camera placement was so brilliant. And I don't know, I have this thing with 1950s filmmaking, as I think I discussed with you at some point, outside the context of this episode podcast. But I don't know, just that time in America is just visually interesting, I think, because it is so American. Mm-hmm. In that sort of quintessential, maybe problematic way that we think about this country.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Women. Ladies. The female of the species. Sometimes livelier than the male. Always deadlier. This is Fifth Avenue. Here, women who can't afford it go to look at women who can. And this is Sydney's, where you can get a shampoo, set, and manicure, and the latest dirt about your next-door neighbor, all for one exorbitant price. Where pounds and reputations are both lost in the steam room, and one woman's poise is another woman's poison. But don't get me wrong. Some of my best friends are women.
Good morning, Duncan.
Good morning, Miss Penrose. We're all ready for you.
Thanks.
Miss Penrose, my husband and I saw your new play Saturday night. How do you ever think to write all those devastating lines?
I don't. I just listen to the talk around here.
Good morning, Miss Penrose.
Hello, Violet. Who's in the house today? Anybody worth avoiding?
I wouldn't know about that. The Duchess of Wimbledon is here, though. And that lady that threw the knife in her husband last year.
Out already?
Oh, and yes, your friend, Mrs. Fowler. Would you like me to get a dryer next to her?
No, thanks. I'll take the knife thrower any day.
Simply crazy about her, and all the time he was pinching every fanny in the place. And, oh, hello, Miss Penrose. I'll take you right after I finish Mrs. Fowler.
Fine, over.
Amanda, darling. Why didn't you tell me you were coming over here? I'd have stopped by and picked you up. It's
my dear friend, Sylvia Fowler. If you've got Sylvia for a friend, you don't need any enemies. Her husband Howard made his fortune in a little paper miracle called Hanky Pants. It kills me to think every time I blow my nose, I make Sylvia richer.
Oh, okay, well, the first time that we see Kay is at that little, I think there is just like a lunch party, a luncheon of some sort, and everybody at the table, with the exception of Kay, has jungle red nails, which is the indication that they all went to Olga, and that means that they all know about Stephen's extramarital affair. When Sylvia tells Kay to go get these nails, recommends it, why? This is something that really frustrates me. Why doesn't Amanda prevent her from going to Olga?
Right, right. Now, I have a younger sister who has a very complicated friendship network, and she considers herself to be a pot stirrer, which is not something that I ever considered would be part of a friendship. But sometimes, you know, it's like what Michael Caine said about the Joker. Sometimes people just want to watch the world burn. Maybe that was the motivation.
You think that about Amanda?
I don't know. I honestly have a lot of trouble discerning who was who, if it wasn't Kay or Steven or Crystal. Those are kind of my mates.
Or Debbie. Little Debbie, if you will. Okay. Well, in your... It sounds so bad. It's like an insult. But your sister would more likely be the Sylvia character, which is bad.
Yes, I would say so.
Because she's the pot-sealer. But Amanda, as we see throughout, because Amanda, like, swallows up multiple characters from the play, which I will get to. But she does seem to be the closest friend that Kay has and the most authentic. She's the one. So she swallows up Mrs. Moorhead, which is Mary Haynes' mother. And she swallows up Miriam, even though there is a Miriam character here, but she does basically the heavy lifting that Miriam should have done. She brings Kay to Bermuda. She has Debbie when Kay goes to get a Reno divorce. You're not going to trust your child, which is, you know, Joe Schmo off the street. She's the one that she comes to Reno to ride back with her. This is like a tried and true friend.
Yes.
But in this instance, because that's later. In this instance, I don't know what she's thinking. She's giving the side eye, right? The bombastic side eye to Sylvia. Edith is also doing the same thing. I think symbolically she breaks a celery stick, I think, at the end as if it were Sylvia's throat. She despises Sylvia. I don't know why she would not step in and tell Kay, like, oh, maybe you don't go there. Or is that the opportunity also to tell Kay that this is what's going on? The question popped up in the previous episode for 1939 of whether you would want to discover something like this on your own, or would you prefer someone, a close friend, to tell you? Not someone like Sylvia, who is going to delight in this because something's happened, but, you know, a close friend. Do you have a personal preference? I mean, I don't want this, you know, to happen to anyone, but circumstances happening, would you want to find out on your own, or would you want a good friend to tell you that he or she or they have seen your partner doing some things that they shouldn't have been doing?
Right. I mean, I suppose, oof, yeah, that's a tough one. I think from Amanda's perspective, you know, it could be like a don't shoot the messenger, because I imagine that would be a difficult thing, because, you know, delivering bad news, nobody wants to do that, especially to somebody you care about. But I think if it was something of this magnitude, then you probably would want it to be in a more, in a safe space, perhaps. Obviously, we didn't have that concept back then. But I think from the recipient's perspective, from my theoretical perspective, yeah, I mean, I would much rather have it delivered by somebody close, because I think that, I mean, perhaps Kay's best moment in the film is when she hears that news from this, you know, third party, from this stranger, and suddenly all that sort of kind of over the top acting darkens and narrows a little bit into something a little bit more subtle, something that isn't communicated solely through dialogue. She kind of turns away and she's deeply ashamed and deeply embarrassed. And I imagine that that's probably what I would feel too. If this just sort of, you not only are you realizing that this is happening, but that it's essentially common or public knowledge.
Yeah. And that she's the last one to know, and it's her own life.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing. Yeah. I mean, oh my gosh, I don't know. I just wish, you know, I think a big thing in terms of the discussion over feminism that I had with Professor Coca is that, you know, a big part of that is women supporting women. And here, and I'll ask you, you know, later on whether you feel like Amanda's feminist or not. But, you know, that could have been the moment where she's, you know, supporting her. And maybe it's something that she does outside, you know, not in front of all these people who know Kay's business already, but she talks to her and tells her that. But I think there's absolutely the danger of don't shoot the messenger. I think that comes down to what that relationship looks like and the love and trust built between those two women. But gee whiz, yeah, I would rather hear it from a good friend of mine rather than find out on my own and be last to know, sort of thing. But yes, that is very hard. Well, even that, oh my gosh. Yeah, even that particular scene that you just mentioned, which was backstage, well, not really backstage, but on the side as Kay just zipped up Crystal Allen's dress. And Sylvia's like, of all the nerve, all that. But even how she deals that information to Kay is just without any sort of sympathy or anything, as if she already thought that she knew, which is an interesting change as well. Yeah, pot stirrer she is.
Pot stirrer.
He's shaking his head. Doesn't look so good.
You want to make a bet? What man could say no to her?
Maybe one closer to home than you think.
Oh, you're so inventive, darling. I ought to go to you for plots.
You ought to go to someone.
Let's talk about the ticket sale, huh?
You just can't stand Kay's happiness, can you, Sylvia? Get you down.
That's ridiculous. Why should it?
Because she has the grace to be what she is.
Which is what?
A woman.
And what are we?
Females. The lost sex. Substituting fashion for passion and the analyst couch for the double bed.
Really, Amanda, maybe it would be much better for Kay to know the truth about Stephen.
The truth. A lot of gossip from a babbling manicurist who...
Oh, I forgot. You had your nails done today, too. Well, then we can all let our hair down and talk frankly, can't we?
Sylvia, if you spread that vile story around, I'll
break... Here I come. Ready or not.
So we'll talk, I think, a little bit about Crystal here. I kind of go through my questions. Listeners are very much... almost like a commentary. It kind of goes through everything, so it's very much in sequence of the film. But in this adaptation, it seems like Stephen and Crystal had a dalliance or two, but they aren't really together.
Yeah.
Crystal, I would say that she's pretty desperate. I don't think it's love-based. I think it is financial-based. You can please give me your opinion on that. But because she is so desperate to get him back, and he puts her off multiple times, do you feel like it's easier for the audience to excuse Stephen and be on his side rather than make him out into, you know, the adulterer that he is, and more of an antagonist or villain?
It's kind of funny. I didn't think about it like that, but that was kind of what I was feeling, which was like, why is Stephen so sympathetic? It feels like kind of a movie at war with itself when you get down to it, because why is his character massaged in this way? So why is Crystal characterized in this way? And I mean, I don't know. I it was hard for me to kind of feel what I think the movie wanted me to feel about Crystal, because I would read descriptions later that were like, oh, gold digging Crystal. And I think that obviously that term is so, just generally sexist and stereotypical that it's difficult to make that claim, even divorced from it. And so it's hard to presume why somebody would be in a relationship, because I think no matter what, presumption is always going to be at the base of that, even for a fictional character, I suppose. It's just hard. It's hard to say like, oh man, she's so obviously bad, or this is so obviously wrong. I mean, I guess if she knows that he's married, then sure, like that, let's work from that. But pulling in other sort of immoral aspects, I think is unnecessary.
Do you think Stephen loves Kay?
Yes.
Okay, I would agree. I think that this, another departure from the play is that you can really see that here. I think that there is a lot of conflict with him, which again, it sounds weird to say, but it is a bit of a problem in what the message should have been that they're delivering. It really is muddied. Like, yeah. I said, there's just not a lot of substance, because I think if you really want to focus on these women and what it's like to go through all of this and see this arc for Kay, then you can't have us kind of forgive Stephen or be like, well, you know, he fell into a man trap, you know, because he keeps saying, like, he sends Crystal flowers and says, you know, it's easier this way. And then she finagles her way into the park. And then he's like, no, no, no. So he very much is like pushing her. It's like a Tyler Perry film. He very much is like, you know, pushing her off. And so he seems like a good guy, and that's not, I mean, the focus should be on the women, not like trying to excuse the man and be like, but she should forgive him and not divorce him. So it's too much. There's too much conflicting feelings, I think, going on here to make this a good adaptation, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's the inclusion of him, and I guess of men by extension, is sort of the crux of it, where why consciously include this guy if not to make him out to be the goodest dude ever, and right. also have him played by Leslie Nielsen, who at this point was a pretty solid leading man character. I mean, he would not become the sort of Frank Drebin until maybe decades after this. I don't know.
Yeah. So then, now this happens later, of course, but why do you think Steven ends up marrying Crystal?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are no clues in his life that would really point to that conclusion. So I can say I honestly don't know.
Okay. I can only guess. I think, honestly, it's because of the vacuum that's created with Kay's absence. I think it's a psychological issue with men not, especially in this time period, if you think about kind of the rise of feminism, you know, and how people were starting to get freaked out that women were, I mean, a little bit later than this, but, you know, women were becoming more independent. What does that mean for men? Men not wanting to be alone. So I feel like a lot of that might be happening here. And so he sees someone who looks at him and admires him the way that he wants to be, and so decides to go for it. But he's clearly miserable.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting that he happens to be with her. So in this case, at the very end, they both rush to each other with open arms rather than the 1939 version of just Mary rushing to Stephen.
Mm-hmm. I forgot that one of the things that was not clear to me, but it kind of made sense in retrospect, was that Kay is supposed to be a former star.
Yes.
I feel like maybe that should have been part of it too, that maybe he had this sense of like, oh, I mean, essentially what men continue to do today, which is like why there's so many celebrity divorces when the woman turns 40, that like, oh, time to trade in the old model for the new one. But yeah. In this case, there did not seem to be considerable age gap, except for maybe in like personal maturity. But even that, I think, is arguable.
And I can't tell with that flashback that we have of Stephen and Kay's first meeting what the age difference might be.
Yeah.
He was a captain, I think. So he's put, like, some time in there. And I don't know, you know, is this a USO show that she's putting on? Is she pretty young? Yeah, I couldn't say. So 10 years. This is apparently how long it takes for a man to get bored. Would you agree with this? How long have we known each other? Are we coming up on a bad time?
Wow, I certainly hope not. Well, I guess 10 years ago, in 2013. No, I mean, we're not even close.
No, we're not. Oh, we're safe, friends.
We're safe. For now.
For now. Yes, that is correct. But no, this is brought up a couple times that like 10 years is the thing. It's kind of nuts. I guess once a decade passes, everyone thinks it's time to change something. They're looking at their lives and examining themselves.
Maybe. I mean, that sort of is the way we're conditioned to think in terms of decades and stuff like that. But I think that research into the psychology of love has advanced since 1956, obviously. The figure that I heard actually was 7 years. So maybe they're not too far off.
Okay.
Either way, it's a...
In
it's
real
a
life, the figure you heard? Or in the
yeah,
film?
That, no, in real life, that like you start life. To get tired. 7 years. Yeah, 7 years.
Wow. Okay. Oh, yeah, because what is that, the 7-year itch?
Oh, yeah, I suppose so.
I guess that's what it is. That's interesting. I wonder what that is, like, psychologically, what's happening.
Right. Nothing good.
Oh, okay. Well, another fun question before I start getting into more serious territory here, but what'd you think about the banana song?
You know, that's probably not going to make it onto my playlists, but... I think it was sort of emblematic of how this movie was billed as a musical, but yeah. It isn't a musical in the sense of like when characters' emotions get too much to be contained in dialogue, they explode into song. It's just they go to musical shows and you sort of just watch a musical number for 3 minutes and it really just disrupts the narrative. And this one in particular was, I was definitely not watching it as attentively as I might have been at once.
Listen, what was it called? The gold something? Yellow gold?
Yellow gold. Banana tree?
What was it about? What was it about? I don't know. Do you think it was a phallic situation?
Oh, wow. I wonder if that even would have been too much
For the code.
For the code. I mean, when I think of bananas, I only really think about, like, banana republics, but I don't know if that was going on around that time. It was supposed to be maybe a coded political statement. I don't know. Because yeah. It can't just be bananas.
I know. Well, he does do kind of like a stripper dance on the pole. Yeah. But he is surrounded by women.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
I don't know what to say. And the women are wearing pink.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what to say. That would be my only thing. Apparently, that was a whole... I was trying to figure out, is this a variety show? Is this... Is this a musical? And apparently it is like a full musical about Yellow Gold. I don't know. The best part of that was just Edith trying not to upchuck because yeah. She just had a banana sundae. And then the woman behind her constantly shushing her. But even the, oh my gosh, if we're talking about sexist, that musical number with the psychiatrist
yeah.
and the man... And how ever since he was 10 years old, he thought about curls and how they're connected to girls, girls, girls.
Yeah.
And then he has a list of women and they're doing different things. So the musical numbers are, yeah, they're a bit nuts, I would say. And those two are weird. And it was also weird to like look over at Kay and Sylvia smiling. you know, on the side stage, as if they are you thinking about what they're actually singing about? And then we have, they're all intrusive, I would say. Maybe the least intrusive was Kay Ashley Redux when she came back and was restarting her career, which I will get back to. But even the sort of the flashback of Stephen and Kay's first meeting. You saw that musical number, and then it transitioned to Perfect Love that she sings in real time. Yeah, so a lot of them did seem shoehorned in. I would agree with you.
Yeah.
So much plenty, every man can get a share. A place where every man is a bananionaire. Yellow gold on the trees, the banana. Yellow gold on the trees, the banana.
Get a good look at her now. August said she's got a sensational figure.
Yellow gold on the treasures untold on the yellow gold on the trees, the banana. Trees, the banana. Trees, the banana. Trees, the banana.
Close in here, isn't it? I should have eaten that banana split. Oh, Edith, this is no time for morning sickness. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I know that. But does my stomach. Shh.
Did you like the Perfect Love and that flashback, though? Do you feel like that added to the history of Stephen and Kay?
I have a bit of a soft spot for flashbacks, so I like that structure, and I guess I appreciate the game, but in this case, I don't think that the present day scene and the past scene existed in enough dialogue or created enough dialogue to really signify much of anything. So I wasn't getting too much out of it other than the sort of classic, like I'm singing this song and being sad about it, but nobody can tell that I'm sad.
Yeah. Nobody. Well, yeah, until she breaks at the end, which I felt like that was a pretty good scene. It was also interesting. I was watching her, you know, I have trouble acting in real life, so if I'm upset at someone, it's hard for me to pretend I'm not upset with that. So she does that with Stephen, but I'm also watching her interact with the people who also knew her dirty business, like Sylvia. I feel like she should have given Sylvia kind of the cold shoulder as well, but she's kind of gal-paling around with her at that particular party. But I have very strong feelings about Sylvia, for sure.
Well, this next one we ain't gonna play. Not while we got the original here in person.
Oh, come on. Oh, you got it. Come on, your old theme song. Joe, you remember Kay's theme song?
Sure.
Well, go ahead, make with the introduction.
I don't even remember the words.
When you find a perfect love. If you please, Joe, the introduction again.
When you find perfect love, no other kiss but his can touch your heart. All at once your dreams are silver line, two hearts as one combined. can find a world apart. And then you know the perfect thrill that all the wise men still can't know the meaning of. Yours the warm and yours the glow when at last come to know the wonder of a perfect.
So Amanda, as I said, she swallows up several different roles. In the role of Kay's mother, she is the one who talks to Kay about, you know, basically men, this is like a trope now, you know, men do this, and giving her advice and things like that. But do her words lack impact on what she is saying if she doesn't have the actual experience, in particular of a marriage? Because originally this came from Mrs. Moorhead. Mrs. Moorhead, Mary's mother, and Mrs. Moorhead says that, yeah, your father also cheated on me, and it's just something that we have to kind of shoulder and move on with. Amanda's saying this in as a friend and as a writer, because she writes these situations. Did you have any thoughts on this particular conversation, which in the play and in the 39 version is a very heavy conversation?
Yeah, I mean, it would make sense. It would make more sense if she had that sort of specific experience. But I think that in this case, I don't want to say... Well, again, I guess I don't want to presume about this fictional character's history. I don't know what she's pulling from to impart this advice. But again, this kind of goes back to the problem of substance in the movie, that these characters are often so inscrutable that these conversations seem to happen arbitrarily often. So I don't know.
I guess it's, you know, what we critique writers for now, right? If a white writer is writing, I don't know, an enslaved person's, you know, fictional story, or like historical fictional story, we're like, you know, we give a side eye, like, well, you know, you're not necessarily pulling from experience or, you know, a personal connection there. And here Amanda is apparently, I don't know what she's writing, but I know that she's writing some fiction, obviously. And so I don't know if she's researching kind of in the circles and seeing how people are, and she's getting that sort of information. Yeah, I don't know. It's just interesting that she clearly brings up, oh, I write about all of this all the time, so I know just about. And it's different for someone not having experienced that to talk to someone who's currently going through it.
Kay, this isn't a new story. I've written it a dozen times myself. It happens to most wives. He's been married 10 years.
As simple as that.
As simple as that. When women get doubts about themselves, they change their hairdo, or buy a new dress, or redecorate the house. Oh, I suppose a man could redo his office, but he never thinks of anything so obvious. A man only has one solution: to see himself for a moment in the mirror of some new eyes.
It's very touching.
This girl means no more to him than a few weeks, and it'll just be something he wants to forget, unless you...
Thank you for trying, Amanda, but no thanks. I've seen all those plays you've written, and I've read all those articles in the magazines. What to do about the other woman? Well, they all left out just one thing. What to do when it happens to you?
There's only one thing to do. Nothing. Ignore it. Keep still when you're aching to shout. That's about the only sacrifice an overprivileged wife has to make to keep a man.
And what if I don't want him on those terms?
You love him, don't you?
I'll get over it. People do.
Look, I'm leaving tomorrow for a few weeks in Bermuda. Why not come along? Get some fresh air and then decide what to do. What the devil, you can always wreck your marriage.
It's already wrecked.
You know, now might be a good time to take a little inventory of yourself. Maybe you haven't been perfect either. Or worse yet, maybe you have.
I'll get back to Amanda multiple times. Okay, the confrontation scenes, I will say, well, we can connect two of them. We have a verbal confrontation between Kay and Crystal, and then we do have a physical cat fight between Gloria and Sylvia, which I will say is even more out of control than the 1939 version. And Gloria is the name for Miriam. Let's begin with the verbal one. What do you think about this? That is this in line with kind of Kay's character? It's really Debbie. Debbie is the reason or the catalyst for her kind of bucking up and deciding to go in and talk to Crystal because she doesn't want Crystal around her daughter. Does this seem like, yeah, that makes sense character-wise? Everything she says to Crystal makes sense. Do you have any thoughts on this particular one?
Yeah, I'm kind of torn on this. I mean, you mentioned criticizing writers. I think just trying to think of this from the perspective of a writer, it's perfectly logical that her maybe default non-confrontational nature would sort of become something else when you've crossed this line. Yeah. But at the same time, I feel like she's no longer fighting for herself when she does this. It's like, oh, my, you know, you can mess with me in my life, but as soon as you involve my daughter, that's when the gloves come off, and it's like, well, that's, I mean, I guess it's a different kind of feminism, but it doesn't seem to be the one that we were going for here.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, why did it take? And that this is true of the play in the 1939 as well, that's kind of the last thing to crack and push her over the edge. And again, Sylvia being the one to drop that information. I don't know how it happened in the play because it's kind of off-panel land. We just hear about them being in the park. And in the play, it's more likely that Stephen may have set this up. But this is perverted a bit because Crystal shanghais Debbie and Stephen hanging out.
Yeah.
So it is kind of completely different. And Stephen's saying no, no, no. But that's, I think it just points to Sylvia and her character as well as the gossip mill. And that obviously, just like playing telephone as a kid, things get messed up between sources, and so you saw this, but you actually don't know what was going on. It's interesting because, and I'll get to likability of these characters and relatability, but Kay here, I haven't really bought into her yet. I don't know that I ever do in this particular adaptation, whereas Mary Haynes in 1939, I felt like I was immediately on her side. There's some sort of wall that I can't break through to get to Kay. But when we get here, she just seems like so very spiteful. And I guess it's the jungle red. I mean, we'll talk about it at the end, too. It's just like this quick character shift that all of a sudden, like, you always have meanness in you, and it's just waiting to kind of come out. But up until this point, this is like not the Kay that we have seen. She's not really pushed back against Sylvia, which is something we saw in the previous adaptation, knowing that she can get annoyed and be upset. But here it's just like she always has her head in the clouds and seems just very sweet, sweet and naive. And now, bam, there's a switch, and she really goes after Crystal and practically calls her trash. I don't know. Do you feel like it's – so you think it was in her and it makes sense?
I don't know. I feel like
– it's too quick.
Maybe it was too quick, but I also feel like maybe the movie needed something to happen, so this was something. I mean, the first question that you had sent me on the rubric was, are there men? And I didn't immediately know what that meant because I didn't know at the time that the women, the play did not feature men.
Yeah.
So I was kind of, well, like, you know, what's up with this world? I mean, it takes place in the 1950s, but it doesn't exactly comport with how I think about that time period. A lot of the unsavory aspects of life, especially for women, don't seem to exist for these characters. But if it had, and maybe this is just not something that the movie filmmakers could have done or would have thought of at this point, but if it had, if, you know, Kay was living a life of sort of this terrible repression and, you know, she wanted these things for her career and her husband was saying no, or she wanted to get out of relationships, she couldn't do that because there were just no recourses around her, then maybe that meanness would exist inside of her and it could only be vented out to another woman. But that's not really what happens here. So it does just feel like, well, the plot kind of requires this to happen. Context be damned, I suppose. So yeah, as theoretically interesting as it is supposed to be, I think in practice it was kind of not great and then problematic, as we might find if as we delve into the Crystal character later.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, she's living a pretty nice life.
Yeah.
There's nice really house. Nothing, yeah, much that's holding her back. There is a moment when she gets that record of, like, a remastered version of her Kay Ashley record, that she has a face, and the man who gives it to her, her friend, says something like, I guess he asks, like, if he did the wrong thing, and she's like, no. And so I was trying to interpret that face. Like, is there resentment that she's not Kay Ashley anymore? But it's not like her husband said, you know, don't do this. And even he, I think, was saying something about, you know, bringing Kay Ashley back. Perhaps it was more like nostalgia for the time, because, of course, they put on one of the songs, horn player or bugle boy, I can't remember what it was called. And then, you know, there's a connection there. But, yeah, there is just that one moment. But everything else, yeah, what she wants, she gets. And it seems like she has a good relationship with her husband and her daughter. And, yeah, there's no abuse. And, yeah, I don't know. She just snaps. So I guess anyone, even the quiet ones, can snap. You've snapped at me. So I guess that's true.
Yes, and you have snapped at me. But that was only when you returned to serve. That was not meant for you. Too much inside jokery. It's funny, though. I mean, it's funny you mentioned the word nostalgia, because it's interesting that their relationship's high point that they look back on, or just their inception, was during the war. So it's like, oh, wasn't that such a great time for us?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. What would you think that would have been, Korean or World War II?
I suppose so.
Yeah.
She may be a perfectly marvelous playmate for Stephen, but if you think she's going to do your daughter any good... Get out, Pat.
What?
And keep the others out.
What are you talking about?
I got a feeling the lid's going to blow off around here any minute.
Go on, get out.
Oh, boy.
Hey, undo the top.
Okay.
All right.
You've been seeing my daughter. I want you to stay away from her.
Doesn't Stephen have something to say about that?
What Stephen does is his own business, except about our child.
Don't worry, Mrs. Hilliard. I'm not interested in children.
He couldn't be in love with you.
Then he's been giving an awfully good imitation. What are you beefing about? You've got everything that matters. The name, the position, the money.
Everything that matters to you.
Oh, cut the dramatics, Mrs. Hilliard.
I was told you were clever. You must be. To keep Stephen from seeing how cheap you are.
Don't give me that innocent bit. I do kicks, you platoons. We both knew a good thing when we saw it. What's the matter, Mrs. Hilliard? Did I hit a nerve?
Just a bit of advice. If you're dressing for Stephen, not that one. He doesn't like anything quite so obvious.
Thank you. But when Stephen doesn't like what I wear, I take it off.
So, there is no discussion before Kay goes to Reno between Kay and her daughter, Debbie. Mm-hmm. This is why I said there's no substance to this. Because in the play, there is a serious sit-down, and even Mrs. Moorhead says, Mary, you need to talk to your daughter, because this affects her, obviously, this divorce. There's a serious sit-down between her and her daughter, and as Professor Coca said, very textbook of going through and, like, you know, feelings change sometimes. Just because mommy and daddy don't love each other does not mean that, well, we don't love you. The daughter would have found out at that point she was going to be living with her mother. We don't get that. We don't get anything. It's a very serious and deep and strong scene, and we don't get that. Thoughts on its absence. Does it just not fit tonally with this, or is it just a glaring error that Debbie doesn't? I mean, when Debbie appears, it's kind of superficially.
Yeah, I suppose in this case, it's consistent with the fact that they don't really seem to have much of a relationship. It's like, oh, that's my daughter. She's around when it's convenient to make me look good or something. So yeah, learning that those scenes should have existed makes a lot of sense.
That was very disappointing. I was waiting, and then she just gets on the train. She's waving goodbye to her daughter, who's hand in hand with Amanda. Maybe Amanda does the heavy lifting in terms of the particular things. Okay, Reno. We move to Reno, and this I forgot to ask in the previous episode what Professor Koga thought about this scene overall. But when I get to this scene, whether it's in the film or it's in the play, I just feel pulled out of the story. I know that this is a necessity. I know that Reno is just this big place to get divorces, but I just feel like it's almost distracting from, you know, the actual stuff that's going on in New York City. Did you feel pulled out of it, or did you kind of go along with it?
That's interesting. In that way, it kind of reminds me of like the Sicily sequence in The Godfather, which I guess people like, but for me, that's always been like, ugh, now it's the Sicily scene or sequence. Although that one kind of at least intercuts with what's going on literally in New York. In this case, I guess I was ready for a change of pace. I didn't really understand what was going on anyway, so I was like, okay, now we're going here. Suddenly, she meets up with these two women. I don't know if they're just introduced into the film now or if they were somebody she already knew, but that was also confusing. So
yes, she meets the Countess and Miriam, aka Gloria, on the train, and this is when she first meets them.
Oh, okay, all right, that makes sense. I guess it is kind of weird, and maybe it's just unavoidable, and perhaps the original playwright did the best that she could with sort of transplanting a character out of their environment and trying not to have that disrupt the narrative totally in this film, which is obviously not as well written, I suppose we could say, as the play. Yeah, I don't know. It's so hard because it's not like the New York stuff was that much more compelling in this case. So I don't know. Hard to say.
Yeah, with the 1939 version and the play, at least you have the vast majority of the, I shouldn't say vast majority, you have a greater collective of people moving from New York City to Reno, so it seems like you're just moving, you're just shifting settings. We've gotten rid of a character named Peggy, which I do have a question on this. I'll have to talk to you about who Peggy is to see if you would have preferred a Peggy in there. And then, of course, we do see Sylvia. So perhaps it's just Peggy's absence that makes it seem a bit more interesting. But in building up the cast over there in Reno, then we also bring them back over and sort of things shift, like Sylvia's knocked out of the circle, and then you bring in the Countess and Gloria. So there's kind of a change there.
Yeah.
That it felt very strange because everyone on the train was crying except for the Countess, who is having a gay old time, and Gloria, who's like, yeah, you're offering champagne, let's do it. And then Kay is also seemingly able to get over her drama as well. So it's just this weird juxtaposition of people who don't want to get divorced but are forced to get divorced for whatever reason. And then these women who are also kind of forced to get divorced, but they're like okay with it. It was very tonally, I was just jarred, I would say, for that particular scene.
Yeah. And I mean, it makes sense just in terms of it's almost like this is the sequel. Like she's moved to this other place with this completely new cast of characters, and yeah, the on-ramp to that was maybe not as smooth. At least the biomes are distinct enough. I mean, they're probably shot next to each other on the same studio lot, but they managed to make Reno feel like a distinct enough place from New York that is more earthy, and you have this sort of woman character walking around in like a cowboy outfit, and there's this
And that, so Lucy is in the play, and Lucy presents, and because I don't know how much we're gonna have to talk about it with the socioeconomic status, but there's always this tension in the play between, whenever you see them together, the working class and then these high society women. And Lucy, when we see her as a working class woman, also adds a contrast to these women who are getting divorces either for shallow reasons or because one or both parties have cheated on each other. And Lucy has kids and an abusive husband and even like talks about that. And so you like see these two different characters like talking to each other that have very different pasts and experiences, and you realize like how different their worlds are, but we don't see that at all really with Lucy. I think mainly because of the Buck character kind of takes all the oxygen out of this particular setting, in my opinion. Do you recall if Sylvia was just getting divorced or did she have an affair?
This I do not know.
Okay. I didn't catch it here either. It's very interesting that they keep changing that detail, because her husband was having an affair, but she was also having an affair in the play. But they kind of changed that. I wonder if they just want Crystal to be the person who's morally dubious and not anyone else. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm about to say something that seems very strong, but I do think that there's truth in what I'm about to say. Inevitably, when you have men involved in the world, there will be at least one that will be an assaulter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I would say, tell me if you agree with this, that Buck, in what we see, assaults Kay.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, there's a famous moment from the show It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia where Dennis, who is this sort of sociopathic, I mean, he's sort of like the womanizer character, but in the show he's portrayed as a sociopath, talks about the implication that they're going to get a boat, they're going to get a bunch of women on the boat and go out into the ocean, and they're going to have a mattress. And the other guy is talking, he doesn't understand why they need a mattress. And he's like, well, we're out in the ocean, you know, things are getting hot and heated. What is she going to do, say no? Of course not, because of the implication. And that's, I suppose, what's going on here, although maybe backwards, because as it turns out, Kay can swim, but he cannot.
But he cannot, yeah.
A coercive, regardless. But I thought that it was kind of, he was so hapless with everything. And maybe they were even developing some sort of rapport. I couldn't really tell just based on reading the scene, like what she was feeling exactly. So the accusation, I suppose, surprises me, but it doesn't, I'm not like shocked by it. I mean, that's a totally fair reading.
Well, do you think that you are somewhat brainwashed because media, I'm doing that, I'm like talking about myself as well, but media, things I've seen also with like K-dramas and stuff, where one party kind of goes in and the other party is like pushing against the other party and then like lets up and then puts their arms around the other person.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's been a pernicious myth that we've been dealing with, you know, through Game of Thrones and everything, the whole yes or no becomes yes, and even for more romantic things, as you mentioned. So, yeah, that's definitely a problem. It's also, I couldn't really tell just based on who Buck was or what he was being described as, that this was something that he does with everybody. So I thought maybe it was some sort of like a tour or like a tourist thing, but maybe, I don't know.
No, I mean, even in my notes, I'm like, serial rapist, ? Or serial assaultist. But he goes after, when he started, I was like, please let this not be what's going to happen. And as he's like getting closer to her, I'm like, hey, you need to, I don't know, you need to do something. And then he just like attacks her with his lips and she's pushing against him. And it is one of those Gone with the Wind sort of dubious moments of like what's going on, because she did grab the oar at one point, then lets the oar go. And but I feel like if you're pushing against someone, that's anything other than a yes is a no. Okay. Yeah. So if she's pushing, I just didn't like it. And we're now, the issue is we're looking at this at 2023, if I'm to date this podcast. And these 2023 eyes are not the eyes that people are going to be watching this particular film. But it just, it felt very wrong. The music that was going on with banjo or whatever it was, I think it was kind of a USA song. I can't remember which one it was. Maybe it was Yankee Doodle. I can't remember. But I was just like, they're trying to make this comedic. I really don't like it. But everyone knew about the boat. He's like, the boat, he pulls out of nowhere. Da, 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 yeah. Da. I'm like, okay. So he's done this with multiple women. And maybe some of them, like Sylvia is obviously salivating over him. You know, Crystal, if she were there, I don't know that Kay necessarily made any eyes at him. And I also feel like Kay is a different character, that she's still in love with Steven. So it's not like, I mean, I guess there's lust, so maybe we can say that she's human and da 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 da. But I just feel like this, the Mary Haynes that I know would not have been put, I think, in this sort of situation. Or her character would not have been. I mean, she might have gotten into a boat, but I don't think that she would have let this stuff go this far. But I didn't like Buck. I just didn't like Buck being in this particular film. But I guess if you have one man, you've got to have the other men as well. So.
I guess so. I really thought that was going a different direction, that it was going to be like this was some sort of scheme to make, like, put her in a relationship so that Steven would have some sort of advantage in the divorce. But no, it sort of lacked context entirely, and it was just sort of nothing.
Yeah, I mean, they talk a bit, and then, yeah, it kind of takes a turn.
Yes.
Do you feel like Buck is similar? He's like the male version of Crystal.
Oh, interesting.
His motivations and getting with people financially and all that kind of stuff.
I mean, that would be consistent with how this movie kind of operates, or how it sees its characters, because Crystal definitely occupies a very specific place in, I guess, the American psyche, and so Buck would obviously just be the male counterpart. I think that's true.
Do you think Crystal is in love with Buck?
Oh, I guess not. I mean, they don't really know each other, or haven't had enough time to get to know each other.
Yeah. Lust? I think, maybe. If she has the money from Steven, I think maybe she has the sex from Buck, and she's about to transition and have the sex and the money from Buck because he signed that deal at the end.
Mm-hmm.
He said his quizzical line of 30 to 40 years about marriage was interesting. I didn't quite understand that. Did you understand? Because she says, I can wait. And he said 30 to 40 years. It's like, what a weird number. Do you understand that? Do you think there's something we're supposed to assume or presume about that?
Well, I guess that he just doesn't want to be tied down until he's elderly, I suppose.
Okay. And can't do show business anymore.
Yeah.
Would you like to just drift a while, ma'am? And look?
No. I just like moving along.
Comfortable?
Uh-huh.
I carved this paddle myself, too.
Really?
With a penknife.
There's just no end to your talents, is there?
The catfight between Gloria and Sylvia. Too much?
It was a surprising explosion of violence. And I guess I had a similar problem with it that I did with the Buck scene, which I had a hard time even reading as an obvious scene of sexual assault, which it was, just because I didn't understand. I mean, I just never understand Kay, because the dialogue in this movie is almost entirely composed of like zingers and one-liners and people just sort of like, you know, having comebacks with each other. And so it's difficult to know when they're expressing actual emotions or when they're sort of just pretending. And so in this case, it's like they're just talking, these two women, in just the normal fashion. And I can't discern that there's actual conflict brewing. So suddenly they're fighting each other. it's broken up, and yeah, she just exchanges one friend for another because I guess women are interchangeable also.
Yeah. And yeah. And of course, Sylvia blames Mary, like, did you know about this? She said, no, but you don't love him anyhow. And she's like, what's love got to do with it? Because she's lost her meal ticket, you know, to a certain extent. Yeah. So, yes, that is, I mean, if you can believe it, even more violent than than the 1939 version. Gosh, it seems to go on for a very long time. And they're like being thrown about. I don't even know if they're stunt doubles or if those are the actual actresses, but they're like getting really, I got nervous because they were so close to the fireplace.
Yeah.
Things are being, she threw like a pan, I guess. Whoof. Well, that actress had to trust the other one that pan was not going to hit her in the face. And perhaps it was depth perception. And so like maybe it was like really far away, but the angle of the camera made it seem like it was right by her head. But broken things everywhere, rolling around on the floor, falling onto, it was crazy. It was nuts. That's how much money means to these people. Okay. So Amanda, like I said, trying to friend in this instance, she comes to Reno in order to ride back to New York City with Kay. And here is when we have Miriam's conversation, kind of, with Kay to convince her to fight for him, drop her pride to a certain extent, get back with Stephen. Any thoughts on this particular conversation, which again should have been a pretty big one from the play?
Yeah, I don't think that this is something that Love Advice columnists would give today, because I feel like these days infidelity is such a line that once crossed, there's just no... it's just a point of no return. And maybe that was the case back then, but perhaps this was, you know, it was the early days of divorce even. So it's, yeah, it's hard to say. I think just in a general sense, it's a kind of a strange turning point in the narrative and not what I expected.
Yes. Yeah. And again, she doesn't have that personal experience that Miriam does, because Miriam in the play is able to recount her own sort of failings in that keeping her pride lost her maybe the love of her life, and so that's why she's trying to impart that to Mary. Yeah.
Don't you ever sleep?
Amanda, what are you doing here?
Old writers have to get around. Oh, all right. I thought you might want company for the long voyage home.
Oh, you're wonderful. How is Debbie? And everyone?
Fine. Did everything go through this morning on schedule?
Oh, yes.
Well, what now, Kay? What are you going to do?
Finish packing.
Oh, you know what I mean. Are you satisfied? Stephen isn't. Kay, has it ever occurred to you he might marry that girl?
That's what he wants.
Oh, but that isn't what he wants. She wants it. And she hasn't been wasting any time. I've seen clever operators in my day, but...
You don't seem to understand. It's over.
You played right into her hands, walked wide-eyed into every trap she set for you. And now you've removed Stephen's last protection, his marriage.
Why rehash it?
Because this is wrong. You're not like these jaded, frenetic women shedding their husbands like they shed last year's dresses. Look, Kay, I hate airplanes and I hate cactus. And I hate people who give advice to other people. So I don't know why I've flown 3,000 miles to this godforsaken waterhole, unless it's because I can't stand seeing something good go down the drain.
Maybe it was good once.
Oh, you're talking like a child. What do you think marriage is, anyway? Something safe and comfortable you can take for granted? This is a rough world, Kay, and marriage has to live in it. It has to be won over and over again, as many times as necessary and against all challenges. And anyone who hasn't the guts for it ought to have learned to live alone and like it a long time ago.
Like you?
That's right, like me.
I'm sorry, Amanda, that wasn't very nice.
Well, at least it's a step in the right direction. Stop being so nice, Kay. If you have any feeling left for the guy, get to New York as quickly as possible and tell him.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm just not the fighting kind. Hello. Yes, this is Mrs. Hilliard. New York. Stephen.
Tell him you'll tear that divorce decree into a million pieces and use it for confetti.
So I'll stop here then and I'll ask, do you think Amanda is, Ms. Amanda Penrose, feminist or sexist?
Yeah. Because she was the one who looks after Debbie, right? When Kay goes to Reno. So I think that, like, that's pretty, that's a very literal sense of, like, support, you know, for the sisterhood. That's a positive thing. But, yeah, telling your friend to swallow her pride to go back to her husband who cheated on her. I mean, that's it's very much like, you know, return to status quo. That's the important thing. Compromise. Mm-hmm. Don't stand up for yourselves, or perhaps you've done that too much. You've had your fun. Yeah. So I guess in a sense, it's kind of, and maybe like the film and like the play, it's, you know, there are shades of both.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think, so this character, based off of Nancy, it will become Jada Pinkett Smith's character in The Woman 2008. And in that adaptation, she's a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at this film wondering, could Amanda be a closeted lesbian who's in love with her best friend?
Oh.
She does have a beard. She is next to or on the arm of a man at the very end, that particular dinner. But I don't know. Is there any 56? They're probably not going to be doing that. But could you look at that now and be like, huh, maybe. Maybe she's in love with Kay and trying to help her out.
Hmm. Well, that would be a counterintuitive way to help.
That is true. Yes. Yeah, she would probably try to get her to stay single, and then she can be with her. And I hate to fall into that trap of, you know, society assuming that if you're single at a certain age, you know, you must obviously be queer. But I do wonder about this. And I think there were obviously some threads or some hints maybe that would lead the screenwriter of the next adaptation to make her queer. I would agree with you that the shades of both, especially because she is making her way independently as a writer, and she seems to stay away as much as possible from the cattiness, and except for that one glaring error where she should have said something and didn't, she is pretty supportive. But this particular scene, obviously, you know, what does that mean for you to, yeah, encourage your best friend to go back to the man who cheated on her and drop your pride and all of that? Now, in the play, Miriam and Kay are very much like two halves of one person. Do you feel like this can be said of Amanda and Kay? Like putting them together, you kind of have a full, well-reasoned, wizened woman.
Right. Unfortunately, in this case, I'm not trying to like be funny or hilarious about this, but I feel like putting them together, you still don't come up with a whole of anything. And I think that's kind of the problem with this movie that's maybe particularly acute here, is that there's so much, again, missing context. There's a sense of missing stakes that you just don't really know, like, who these people are or what they want. Because in this case, I mean, there should be some rationale here that, like, the sensible option, maybe the pessimistic option that Amanda is trying to get Kay to realize, is that, like, go back to your husband or else you don't have anything. You'll lose something. But that isn't established. And even Kay's relationship to the something is not clear. Like, it's not clear that she has this lavish party in her home. Does she like these people? Is she afraid of losing them? It's just, there's just none of that. I don't know what you want to call it, connective tissue. And so when you get to a moment like this, like one of the most crucial plot points in the narrative, there's just like, well, what does the choice even mean? Like, what is she going to look like if she chooses this side or versus this side? And so to that specific question of like, do these two women make up something? Yeah, I really just can't say, because there's so little, again, substantive here.
Yeah. Well, I think we get that what if when she goes back and becomes Kay Ashley.
Mm-hmm.
Now she's forced to. She doesn't do it on her own. So We don't know what she would have done given the option, but because Stephen calls and says that he's married Crystal, she really has no other option but to go off on her own. But she does have, you know, the streak of independence by reclaiming that name and acting and singing and all of that. Though, you know, the one song we see her sing is, you know, about a romantic partner. Maybe those are just the songs of the time, but you kind of wish that it were something else. But no, I agree with you. I think there are two different characters, like I could talk about who Amanda is and who Kay is, but I don't, they very much are a ghost of what the play intended for them to be.
Spooky,
yes. Okay, so before we leave Reno, I just want to say about Peggy and see what your thoughts are. So Peggy is a newlywed, and she and her husband, well, her husband wants to divorce her. A lot of it is to do with money that she kind of keeps. She has her own finances and wants to keep some of that, you know, for herself. And this is just a cause of consternation with her husband. I think he just doesn't make as much as she has. And so they're in Reno. She looks to Mary Haynes as her mentor. You know, she certainly asks her questions, and they're trying to make their way through this divorce together. And then her husband ends up calling her and wanting to get back together with her before that divorce goes through. And she is pregnant at the time, so she also tells him that they're pregnant, so they get back together. So this is almost in contrast to Edith, who is perpetually pregnant, which, as we see, I think she has child 7 and is pregnant with 8 by the end of this 50-year film. And kind of the beginning, Mary Haynes or Kay Hilliard, because she is a newlywed. But without, I mean, do you feel like we lose anything by not having very innocent and young character who looks to Kay for advice and guidance?
Yeah, I think that could have added some necessary dimension, because unfortunately, maybe one of the problems of watching this movie with 2023 eyes is that because there isn't that differentiation between women or characters who in this case are primarily women, that you do run into some, maybe not stereotypes, but just this sort of general sense that, like, oh, women are so, they're all superficial and they're all shallow. But I don't know who is this audience that I'm trying to identify. But in that case, I think that could work. You could have, if you wanted to cut Peggy, you could have subbed her with Debbie, maybe have a daughter who, you know, was innocent and looked up to Kay, but that wasn't really the case there either.
No. Yeah, we kind of lose something. And it's really Kay is the character who suffers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you just have this wife who was naive and kind of manipulated by her friends, like her circle. And then, yeah, how do I even describe Kay? I just don't know. Like, I just don't know. Like, I could talk about Mary Haynes, but Kay is just like, what's going on here? And yeah, I think that just gives her a dimension when you have someone that is providing or asking for guidance and provides a mentee role, then you see a maturity to that character, to the Mary Haynes character or stand-in. And I feel like, yeah, we just don't have it because everything is almost about her. Like, it's all about her. And I feel like the story is, yes, it's about her, but her life is also affecting other people's lives.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that would be consistent too with this theme of gossip that,
yeah,
there is, as we'll talk about it, maybe supposed to be a sense of community or a society. And so,
don't wonder about that.
Yeah, but in this case, she is just sort of this person who goes to Reno without telling her daughter. And she's just kind of, you know, she's Kay.
Yeah. Yeah, I just don't. Yeah. Well, I guess we'll get into this likable thing. So a change with Buck is that he's with Sylvia in this adaptation and not the Countess. So this makes it, I don't know that I necessarily have a particular question unless you do, but just I want to make that point because what happens at the very end with the ultimate confrontation, it's much, much more personal, and I think it almost makes it more vindictive Whereas in the play, the Countess is the one with Buck. And Sylvia knows, because she is close with Crystal, she knows that Crystal is having an affair with Buck. And Mary is able to weasel out of Sylvia that information and kind of causes the downfall of that relationship. But now, in Mary knowing that information, she's not only causing... well, she's causing the downfall of a former friend. So it seems a bit more... there are more victims, I guess, at a stake here. So my final question, I guess, that I had was whether you lost respect for Kay in her actions at the end, because she's pretty conniving with what she comes up with. She brings in the gossip columnist, who plays a huge role in this film compared to the previous adaptation in the original. And, yeah, Sylvia finds out in a bad way, which I guess quid pro quo kind of situation. You know, this happened to me, so now it happens to you. But does this run counter to who you think Kay is? Though now we've both kind of questioned who Kay is. But just your thoughts on that whole, I guess, the climax and Kay getting Steven back, but how she was able to get him back.
Well, I suppose theoretically it should indicate transformation, that she was something and then is becoming somebody more able to be conniving. And that should be interesting, or something that we're not sitting here questioning why. I mean, that should just be the narrative. But in this case, I think the way it was handled, it does raise these questions rather naturally. But I suppose, like, you know, if this experience ultimately worked out for her, which it did, because she was able to win Steven back, she has this greater sense of perspective. Maybe she thinks she's doing Sylvia a favor by putting her on this same journey.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's interesting.
But I honestly don't know. It's yeah, it's just hard to say. I guess I kind of appreciate it.
That she you appreciate
does something.
That
I don't know.
She became a bitch.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was basically, that's her character journey. And I'm, like, trying to connect it, you know, to the previous one. It just doesn't seem as heavy. Now, there's collateral damage, because the Countess normally is like, how dare, you know, you knew this and all that. So they lose that particular person in the circle. Mm-hmm. And Sylvia was out of the circle to begin with. But just the way, it just seems worse. Yeah. In this representation of everything that happened. And I think part of it is because she has an agent that's with her. Because I think, you know, so she's bringing people on the outside, a gossip columnist who also went after Kay. She's now doing this to other people. And so, if it had just been Kay, because originally Mary just weasels it out of Sylvia and goes after Crystal on her own, there's really no one else involved. I mean, Peggy is there and actually says, like, who have you become? But there's no, she has no conscience with her. So she brings in this gossip. It just seems really bad. So in losing, she really is, like, dropping her pride, like the pride of her self-respect. It's kind of nuts, because I feel like there are two different prides that we're talking about here. You've got the pride of, like, let's drop this in order to get back your man. But now you've also lost, I think, character. So I personally lose respect for Kay just because I think she gets really, really dirty. And she goes after Sylvia, who's not the best character, but she's also not the one who's having an affair with Steven. So right. If all of this ire and the attack had gone solely at Crystal, that'd be one thing. But I feel like she's really damaging somebody else that, even though I don't like her, I don't know that she necessarily deserved all that.
Right, yeah. I think that would be the area where it would fall down for me also. I do think that having the Countess be more hurt by it in the original would be, like, having that collateral damage is more compelling, just in general sense. But, I mean, at the same time, like, I don't know, I'm like, revenge is something that's very interesting, because I think to the outside observer, it's difficult to empathize with people in that position who feel so aggrieved that they have to sort of reproduce that pain upon somebody else. And it's an essentially irrational thing. But having never been so aggrieved, it's difficult for me to judge in, again, cases where it's even fictional characters. So in this case, especially since it is a woman in a movie called The Opposite Sex, based on a play called The Women, you know, I do kind of want to say, like, well, why can't you just have her destruction of other people? But I don't know. I guess I'd kind of go back and forth on that. But in general, I guess I would say that I appreciate it just because it's like, not only did something need to happen, but also, like, sure, like, be a little bit irresponsible. Like, because I mean, you know, for us both, like, you know, reading comic books, watching horror movies, like, there's always this kind of cosmic sense of morality that women, if they do certain things, they will be punished for it. And in this case, like, this is really not okay what she's doing. And so it's surprising that she can do it and get away with it, essentially. And that's, to me, that is a little refreshing.
Interesting, yeah. And I mean, her outfit is certainly not lost, you know, being that red.
Yeah.
Man, yeah. So, I mean, do you think that this section, the K that has evolved into this final form, this final Pokemon, do you think that she is feminist or sexist misogynist for what she does at the end?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a tough one. And I guess it kind of speaks to the very nature of that question. I mean, it's a question that I've wondered about, I think, on past episodes of podcasts, just like, why is it that it's such a fine line that something can be either feminist or sexist, like, so easily that it could just be flip-flop one or the other? And I think it's just because there's just so much stakes in every case. But in this specific case, in this scene or sequence or where this character ends up, it's kind of like, well, she's feminist in a sense because she's standing up for herself and she isn't minding sort of society's implicit restraints on her own morality, which is something that I think is maybe transgressive even now. But at the same time, she's harming women. And even if they, you know, quote unquote, deserved it, I mean, what does that say? You know, why is it that that's being communicated to us even, that these are people who deserved this to happen? So that part kind of feels gross and weird. So again, I guess for me, it's kind of a cop-out, but it's a bit of half and half.
Yeah, well, I mean, you and Professor Cook are both. It's always kind of a yes and or yes but question, or yes and no question.
We love improv. So yes and.
We're here. I agree with you. I think tearing her down, also the glaring thing is that, you know, she's doing all this to get back together with a man.
Yeah.
Even though obviously love is involved and I am a romantic, but yeah, I mean, she could have been Kay Ashley and be independent on her own. So, but yes, to the, I guess, the feminist prose that you have, I agree with you there.
Just a minute. Why, Dolly, you decided to stay after all.
You knew I would. There's a glint in her eye. What's it all about?
Well, nothing. Yet.
What do you mean, yet?
Oh, and it probably wouldn't even be fit to print.
Oh, come on. You know the motto of my column, from the ridiculous to the slime.
Well, then, perhaps you wouldn't be beneath a little conspiracy.
Me? I invented it. What do I do?
Well, it's really quite simple.
The aspirin landed.
Thank you.
I told you the show was on.
Too bad it isn't over. I can't stand cowboys, even when they're good.
Better give me another one.
Aren't you feeling well, Sylvia?
I feel fine.
You know, you're quite a woman. I don't think I ever really appreciated you before.
Appreciated?
Oh, we've had our differences. I guess all women do. But now that we're in the same boat, well, I must say you're being much more civilized about it than I was.
About what?
Crystal, of course. Sitting at the same table with her as if you were the very best of friends.
We are the best of friends.
You don't have to be brave for me, Sylvia. Of all people, I understand.
About what? What are you talking about?
Buck?
Buck?
The way Crystal's taken him right out from under your nose. You mean you don't know? Oh, you must be joking, Sylvia.
I don't believe it.
Who said so? Crystal? Oh, well, not directly, of course, but by way of every sales girl and manicurist in town. And she is not the discreet type, you know. Well, neither is Buck, so I guess they make a perfect pair.
Kay Hilliard, you're lying. Ever since you lost Stephen, you've just been dying to break things up between Crystal and me.
Well, let me tell you. Well, Kay, I haven't seen you in ages.
Hello, darling.
Where have you been keeping yourself?
Oh, just living the quiet life.
Oh, I know. I never could count on a thing from you.
Well, now, don't write me off. Maybe I have got something.
Oh, no, Kay, you wouldn't.
A nice, hot little item about a certain cowboy and a certain married lady.
Oh, you mean Crystal and Buck Winston?
Old stuff. Everybody in town knows that. I need something fresh and appetizing for my readers. Bless their moronic little hearts. Why don't you cut his throat and give me an exclusive?
Any other thoughts, I guess, before I get to the rubric?
I guess, was there a closing musical number?
I think Stephen and Kay dance.
Uh-huh.
I believe that was it.
I don't really remember. I remember I was scanning papers at the time as the movie was ending, so those details are a bit fuzzy to me.
Yeah, I think there's just a dance between the two. Well, there's a joke of, you know, like, can you tell Mr. Hilliard his wife wants to see him?
Oh, yeah.
Whoever that was, the waiter or whatever, is annoyed and like, no, the other one. Wife. So.
Yeah.
Do you feel like this is fast? Was it a fast film? Speed of dialogue specifically.
Yeah, in that sense, it did remind me of like a Palladino. Amy Sherman.
Oh, Amy Sherman Palladino, yeah.
As you mentioned, Gilmore Girls in the first episode, for my part, what I've seen of The Marvelous Miss Maisel, it actually tracks somewhat closely with that storyline as well. But just in the way that people talk, yeah, it is quite fast.
I would say it's not as fast as, 'cause so much is cut from the play, and then they have these musical numbers. I didn't think it was as fast as the 1939 version.
Yeah. Well, how long was that movie?
2:12.
Really?
But it was nearly verbatim of the play.
Okay. Yeah. So. I feel like I'll probably be branded an essentialist for holding on to this belief, but I mean, movies that are more than 90 minutes tend to drag for me. Just because, like, you know, especially with Hollywood, like, you're following a pretty close script. Movies are made, you know, they're just made a certain way. So I feel like when you kind of have a ballooning runtime, in this case 2 hours, something went wrong. And in this case, like, you can definitely see a lot of just where that bloat is, and you can feel it. So I did feel like this one was kind of a slog.
I'm sure that it would have been, you know, 145, 130 without the musical numbers.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, the banana song seemed to go on for a long time. He sang that chorus so many times, I was like, please move off. And I like musicals, but that song needed to end.
And I like bananas.
And you like bananas.
Take that however you'd like.
Oh, did you find this amusing?
No, amusing is not a word that I would use to describe my reaction to it.
Yeah, I think there were some moments, and I knew which moments were intended to be funny, but I did not find funny. Like the fact that she swims off that boat. I just can't get over that scene. The fact that she's undressing, which I was like, oh my gosh, Kay, do not. And then she jumps and he's like stranded.
Yeah.
There are some moments that I found funny, but yeah, nowhere near as humorous, I think, as the previous. And I know that it was intended to be.
Yes.
But it just did not. It did not feel that way. Again, I don't know if it's 2023 eyes or not.
I don't know, because I mean, I feel like there were funny things around the 50s and even earlier. Like, you know, Buster Keaton is still funny. Groucho Marx, maybe not so much. And this is kind of more in that camp where it's very much like witty. The characters are, the way they talk to each other, it's like, oh, it's very clever. They're zinging each other, but the humor doesn't arise naturally out of the situations. So it's just, it just feels arbitrary and it doesn't feel organic. And that's, I guess that's what I'm looking for. My comedy is organic, but I don't know. Yeah. In this case, I was kind of like, I'm not feeling it.
Okay. Do you find Kay Hilliard likable?
I guess at the very end when she destroys all of her enemies.
Wow.
Again, Corleone-esque. No, I don't know. I had a hard time sympathizing with her and liking her. Because, again, it was just a matter of I don't know who she is. Like, I don't know what her relationship is really like with Steven. I don't know what – I don't feel her loss. Strangely, like, I think the performance is pretty good because she's able to communicate things that are not really set up by the actual script. Like that scene where she learns the news and she just feels so anguished, but I don't know why. Like, well, like what – what's the problem? And it should be obvious. Like, it's, you know, her husband's having an affair, and yet I have no earthly idea why this should concern her.
Yeah. I know she's supposed to be, like I said, there's just this wall for me, and I just couldn't break it down to like her as much. And yeah I don't know that I can verbalize, because I've been thinking about, like, why didn't I care for her as much as I cared for Norma Shearer's Mary Haynes?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. And even, you know, in the next one, I like Meg Ryan's Mary Haynes. So, yeah, there's just something weird about this one. I don't know. I think a lot of it is because they got rid of these serious conversations.
Yeah.
And again, that she's just not a serious character almost. Like, the things that she's worried about are just so superficial. It's like, well, you know, you also have a daughter. So what about that?
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite character? If you were to pick.
Yeah. I guess I kind of liked I can't remember if it was the Countess or the other one who gets into a fight with Sylvia. The cat fight, as I guess we have to call it. I feel like she had some spark, but other than that.
Yeah. Gloria is a shell of what the Miriam character is in the play. But yeah, she was kind of just there for fun. I would say Amanda's probably my favorite character. Just, I felt like there was some depth to her and she was very interesting. And obviously she swallowed up two other characters, so it made her even bigger than just one. So I would maybe put her there. Even though the characters are of a high socioeconomic status, do you feel like the story is relatable? And of course, I'm asking a man, so.
Right. Yeah, that's a tough one. Because I don't think that was the problem, I guess, in terms of relatability. I don't think, because I think that you can tell this story with people in high society and make them relatable. I'm sure that happens on, like, Succession or something, which just ended, or even Mad Men. All of those characters were, like, super rich, but, you know, we cared about their dramas. And in this case, I just think it was their utter unavailability as characters, not so much that they were people of means.
Is this an escapist drama that you would go and be like, well, at least my relationship isn't like that?
I did think that. No, I mean, that's interesting because I feel like, you know, I was trying to imagine what the audience would be like for this movie. And obviously, I don't know exactly what it was like to go to the movies in the 50s. But I imagine that you had this movie house and you would just go there and you weren't so particular. You were like, I'm going to see Star Wars Return of the Jedi because I am a Star Wars fan or whatever. It was just, I'm going to go see a movie. And, oh, it's like a musical. I didn't like that very much. I'm going to go home now. It wasn't so, like, you know, there weren't demographics. It was just entertainment. So in this case, yeah, maybe. I don't know what life was like for the average American necessarily in the 50s, if how they would see this as escapist or not. For me personally, again, I mean, I guess literally would be because it is a very, idyllic sort of Norman, not even Norman Rockwell, but just a very specific version or vision of that time period that, you know, was not everybody's experience. And I don't think is even our experience as modern Americans in the middle class.
Did they show enough of the working class, do you think, in this adaptation to show that there was tension between the two?
I can't say they did. It seemed like everybody was pretty much on the same page. Like when the waiter was sort of talking back to Leslie Nielsen's character, it's like, yeah, maybe there should have been a sense that he had more power over this guy and he would not broach that line. But yeah, that seemed to be a conspicuous absence.
Yeah, really, Olga, and then Crystal, obviously, like the showgirls, Crystal and her best friend. That's really all we see. We don't get, again, Lucy, we didn't get to see that. Buck, you could kind of say also is working class, since we've associated him with or assimilated him to Crystal. And we also lose Kay/Mary having help. We do know that she had a maid, but there's no conversation with them, whereas in the play, she had two of them, and they had a conversation between themselves about what was going down. They kind of act as the exposition. So we do lose that. Yeah, I mean, obviously the story is relatable in terms of these things happen, but I think the characters seem less relatable than the previous adaptation. Again, I don't know what it is about these particular people, but I just don't know that I can see any redeeming qualities in many of them. But I guess it's just they kind of go through the world with not. It's literally like I'm watching reality television. And it's like, yeah. What is your character, you know? What is your strength and, yeah, that kind of thing. It's interesting. So story-wise, yes, characters maybe not as much as the previous incarnation.
What are you doing?
Buck and me.
You heard me.
No, don't be ridiculous, Sylvia. You're not stupid enough to take Kay Hilliard's word for anything.
Oh, I'm not stupid enough to take anybody's word. I went straight to the horse's mouth.
No, I don't believe it. Buck's not crazy enough. You haven't got a thing on me.
Oh, you little...
Sylvia! No violence. Remember, you're a civilized woman.
Oh, look who's talking. Miss Sweetness and Light. You can fight just as dirty as anyone.
That's right. I've been taking lessons from professionals.
You just can't stand it because I took Stephen away from you.
Watch it, Crystal. Your lease may be up sooner than you think.
You're all in this together. But Stephen won't fall for such cheap gossip. He's a gentleman.
Even a gentleman can be pushed too far.
Especially a gentleman.
Yes.
Yes, and I've got plenty on you. Plenty.
What do I care? Nobody will believe you.
They'll believe me, dearie. It's all written down and reads like a dream. You know, I may get the Pulitzer Prize for yellow journalism.
Take my advice, Crystal. Start thinking about your alimony. Alimony? When I get through testifying, Stephen won't have to give her a dime.
And suppose I don't need it?
What are you going to use for money?
Buck Winston.
He's closing tomorrow.
Who would have suspected it of Buck? He's a sensation, an absolute sensation. You're to be congratulated, Sylvia. I hear they're going to sign him for a year. Oh, have I interrupted anything?
So, I don't think we'll need you, Sylvia. Or the Skylight Room. After tonight, Buck can write his own ticket anywhere. We may even go out to California. The smog will be so refreshing.
I think we talked a lot about the relationships. Do you think we need to touch on any of these?
I think we covered them for the most part.
Okay, so then we get to a big question: where is there a community that's been created by the end? A community of women that's positive, uplifting, supportive of each other?
Right. That's an interesting question. I mean, So like when I found out this was a musical, I was a little bit, I don't know what the word would be, dubious, because I am not a self-professed musical fan, but my experience with that genre comes primarily from the television show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, as I think we mentioned on the first season. And in that show, like, that is definitely about a woman who is very much in love with theater, who kind of comes into this new world and creates a community around her, and that's very much at the heart of the story. But Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, of course, was very deconstructive in nature, and perhaps this is why, in the case of the opposite sex, I mean, in order for there to be the creation of a community, I think that you needed to have a sense of absence of that community in the beginning. And I just don't know that there was even a narrative between those two points, because as far as I'm concerned, it's like, well, you have these cliques of women, and then in the end you have slightly rearranged cliques. And I don't know that that necessarily has the same power as the creation of a community.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I guess when I think about this particular question, I think about, do we have a group that, well, inevitably we do have strife and things like that, that it's mostly supportive and loving and positive, and they're not trying to tear people down? And so in that case, I would say mostly yes, because that group, you know, before they go off to the party, seems like they're having a jolly good time. However, I think they do badmouth Sylvia, so there's always a, you know, an exception to everything. And I think, wasn't Edith at that dinner party too, right before?
I don't know.
I think she was, which is interesting because then at the party, she's sitting with Crystal and Sylvia. So I could lean to what your answer is, because it's still like dubious, like, what is this circle? And it's not, I would say it's not as strong as the original and the 1939 adaptation, where you do have a pretty strong core with Miriam, Mary, the Countess, Peggy, because we've lost Peggy. And Nancy is kind of weird, but with Amanda here. So a little bit, but you kind of also wonder, you know, trial by fire. And it seems like the Countess isn't really a part of that circle either, because when everyone gets up to leave to see what's going down in the powder room, the Countess stays.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's symbolic of anything. So perhaps a new community is made. Maybe it's stronger, but it's hard to tell, again, with this less substantial adaptation.
I mean, I think that it definitely is, but I don't love how it is made stronger by excision. Because now Sylvia and, I guess, Crystal, who never really was part of the group, are just not in it. And that's how you make a community stronger. Because one of the cool things about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend was, at least after season 2 and before season 4, you had the departure of a character because the actor literally left the show. And so there was a sense that, like, okay, well, we can sort of reform certain people, like Valencia or even Josh. But if that doesn't work, you know, this isn't the place where everybody has to be. If you can't make it here, then you might just have to leave. That just might be your answer. But in this case, it's like, I don't know, it doesn't have that sort of sensitivity or, I don't know, it's just, I mean, obviously one of the big problems here is that there's just such a sense of, like, good and bad people. And so it like, building the community is a matter of identifying who's bad. And that's kind of weird.
And cutting them out. But don't you think that's true in real life? That if there is, you know, the pot stirrer and it's causing problems for everybody, like, you might all need to come to an individual conclusion that maybe it's best that this person not be a part of the group?
Yeah, I mean, that might be the conclusion that you reach, but I do think that you have to give them a chance first, and I don't think that there was enough back and forth there.
You don't think, oh, well, there wasn't communication, but don't you think Sylvia had enough chances?
I mean, yeah, maybe. I don't know. That's tough. I'd have to think about that one.
And I mean, Sylvia is a bit of a hypocrite. You know how much this particular community that we have loves that word. Because she is upset, I guess, that she wasn't told what was going on with her own husband and that this was happening to her. And yet she was the one propagating, is that the right word? You know, gossip about Mary.
Hmm.
So it's interesting that she doesn't necessarily have empathy or compassion for what went down for Mary when the same thing almost happens to her.
Right. Yeah, I guess there just needed to be some, communication, just a sit down. But again, there are no heavy conversations in this movie.
I think that is the greatest thing there. Does it pass the Bechdel test?
I don't know, but I'm going to err on the side of caution and say no.
Yeah, it's similar to last time, which I guess is just the way it is. Barely. It barely does. And it's interesting now. I think we've gotten to the point where the Bechdel test probably needs to be revisited. And, like, maybe there's a percentage attached to it or something like that. Because to say something passes the Bechdel test is just by saying that, oh, there's one conversation at least. that happens between two women. It's not about a man. But that seems like a really poor, that's like a D minus in my, you know, if there's sure. one conversation, you kind of want the Bechdel test flying colors is like multiple conversations. So I do wonder about that and kind of how this particular test is evolving, if it is. So again, yeah, as a play about women, but also about really about men. And in this case, a film that has men in it and is about men. There's a lot of talking about men. So even the songs are about men. Well, the banana song, not necessarily. The psychiatrist song, no. But Perfect Love is about a man. Well, I guess it depends. Your mileage may vary. And then her song that she sings is about a romantic partner. So, yeah, barely. Barely passes.
Barely. It's barely. Sad. And I guess the fact that so few things pass the Bechdel test is the great commentary. I just as an aside, I remember seeing the movie Neighbors in theaters, and there's a scene. This is the one with like Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne. Yeah.
This family next to a frat house, right?
Yeah. And so when they go over and talk to them for the first time, Seth Rogen talks with Zac Efron and Rose Byrne talks with whoever the main girl character is. And they're talking about guys. And then they cut to Seth Rogen and Zac Efron and they're talking about Batman. So I was like, still, this movie is 2016 and we're still doing this.
Yep. I'm afraid so. And then the last question, really only I can answer because I've read the play and done a deep dive analysis on it. So does this film follow the spirit of the women or the law of the women? Spirit, but barely. Spirit, but barely. Yeah, I mean, between the two, that's really all we can say. Like, I can tell that it's taking its idea from the women, but yeah, no substance is kind of the quote to take away from this particular episode for sure.
I love that phrase, though, the law of the women. That sounds like an 80s movie, perhaps produced by Roger Corman.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Or it could be our future society where men are subjugated by women.
Yes, but I will fight with everything I have to prevent that future.
I bet you would. You know you'd live it up and delight in such a future community.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, any final thoughts on this particular film?
We covered all these other questions in Hypertext Blue.
Hypertext Blue.
I clicked on it.
What like, your? Oh. There are moments that you really show your nerdism, and that was such a moment. Yes, I may have skipped, you know, one or two, but for the most part, yes, I believe so.
So I guess my closing thought would just be about the character Crystal, who bothered me the most.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Let's do it.
I mean, in terms of the central question of this podcast and as it pertains to this movie, I mean, that's really when you kind of give the game away, is when you have a character who embodies that, I guess we would call it the Madonna whore complex. And to further my nerdery, I was watching a video about Guillermo del Toro relatively recently, and he was talking about the difference between like Eastern and Western philosophies, just generally, and that in Western societies, there's a great emphasis on binaries. And that really just makes a lot of sense that, like, you know, in America, we define ourselves in relation to others, which is why we put so much stock into difference and why we have issues, obviously, with racism and sexism. And when we have gray, like queer people or things like that, it short circuits a lot of people who have not exercised their brain muscles enough. And in this case, it's like, well, you have Kay on one side and Crystal on the other side. And Crystal is like this person who is scheming and manipulative. And there's the scene where she's like in the bathtub and Debbie is talking to her. She's like, you don't like me very much, do you, Debbie? It's just like, she's like a cartoon villain. And yeah, I think that that's like, it's just, it's the thing that I like the least, maybe, about movies and storytelling. It was something that I encountered with a movie called Deep Blue Sea, which is about a shark, but was also just very much about like piling on this one female character, and I just didn't know why. And I think that like when you're characterizing villains, like I'm totally fine with a black and white villain. Like I don't subscribe to the notion that every villain has to be sympathetic somehow. But in this case, like it's just, she's a straw man, basically. And so you know, kudos to the actress who portrays her. And I bet that was a fun role to play. But as a character, she's just so simplistic, and she just suggests so much about how the movie works behind the scenes and the approach to its writing. So yeah, that was kind of a problem area for me.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about all of her scheming and, gosh, her overreactions to things, like throwing things and just getting really upset. Whereas I feel like Crystal's a pretty calm, cool, and collected character. And she lets the man come to her. She doesn't chase after the man, which I think is very interesting. And I think that goes again. Like, I think they came in with this idea of, well, we've got Leslie Nielsen. We're going to make this a sympathetic male character who's trying to fight off the affections of a, you know. And so obviously, because you want to lift up this man, you've got to, you know, make this woman as catty and, yeah, manipulative as possible. And in the end, you know, Kay becomes Crystal, which I don't think should be true.
Right.
Even in the original, I don't think she ever fell that low. Yes. So would you say then that Crystal is a sexist / misogynist portrayal of a woman?
I would. Yeah.
With no redeeming feminist qualities.
I mean, they spend a lot of time on her, so you have maybe a sense of her internal life, but that doesn't really come across. I mean, she's just so flatly portrayed. I mean, you could not get away with that these days. So, yeah, I guess I would lean more towards the sexist pole.
Even her friendships. I mean, do you think she really has a true friend?
Right.
Or she can be a true friend?
No, I think she has a long journey of self-discovery ahead of her that she needs to embark upon.
Yeah, which she doesn't even, you know, the big thing about the original is that she knows, like, she's worked before, so she can always have that to fall back on. So when she loses her meal ticket, she's like, you know, at least I have this, you know, I can go, but what do you all have, you know, if you lose your marriages, that sort of thing. And this one, I don't think she has that sort of line where, you know, well, at least I can go back to show business, because I think she says, at least I've got Buck. You know, it's like, well, that's interesting. So you have, like, literally nothing to fall back on, too? Like, yeah, I don't know if she is a working class woman in the body of a high society woman.
Yeah, that would have been interesting.
Yeah.
I wish.
Because she's supposed to be our main point of contact with the working class.
That's interesting.
In a negative way, potentially, if you see this and like, oh, is this how they all are? But here we just have a showgirl. Yeah, and also I don't know if that's saying anything bad about showgirls, too, you know?
Right.
Some sort of insinuation about how they actually are, I couldn't say.
I think that's something that we're still dealing with now is anything even remotely like sex work or, you know, women displaying their bodies for profit and fun. Like, you know, we're still pretty uncomfortable with that as a society.
Yeah.
But yeah, then on the flip side, of course, you have Kay, the Madonna character. And there was a line earlier that I wrote down where I can't remember who said it to her, maybe Sylvia. After she had discovered the infidelity, she says, or Sylvia says, now's the time to take an inventory of yourself. Maybe you haven't been perfect either, or worse yet, maybe you have. Which reminds me a lot of something that Joan said on Mad Men, which is, you know, her only sin was being familiar. But I think in this case, it's kind of a problem, not only because we don't know why Steven cheated on her, and if it is just because she's so perfect, I mean, that's like such protagonist syndrome. I can't even handle it.
Yeah, it's kind of, too perfect equals boring kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's no excitement. I mean, if you think about, you know, like, it smells like Yellow Jackets, right? Where you have, it starts with the next
Shauna. Page,
doesn't it? Yeah, Shauna and her husband. And the reason why she's, like, having an affair is, like, I guess to spice up kind of the sex life. And it's just more exciting doing kind of this sort of stuff. I don't know. It seems familiar in that maybe he was just getting bored and he was trying to, or maybe he thought he was boring because of all of this. But it's interesting how people, are we all, like, as human beings, are we self-destructive? That we're just like, there's something wrong here, or I have to mess it up so it's exciting, even though there's nothing wrong at all. Like, he's a successful producer, he has a loving wife, he has, seems like, a well-adjusted daughter. Yeah, it's kind of nuts.
Well, that's kind of what the opening number is about. The opposite sex, perhaps. You know, it's what makes men do stuff? The opposite sex. So I think these are the questions we're meant to ask. Why do men do what they do?
Yeah, because of women. That's interesting to blame. I mean, that's almost rape culture as well, if that's like the right term there, of like, well, it's obviously the woman's fault
right. That
this happened. You know, what did you do to tantalize him? So what did Crystal do to tantalize? Which in this case, that fulfills that thing, because Crystal did do something to tantalize him. So it's obviously it is her fault. But we're also saying with that commentary, with that quote that you have, what did or didn't Kay do to cause him to stray?
Right.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, like, why would a friend even say that, first of all?
He ain't no friend.
No friend at all. Yeah. So I think what we're also finding is like, well, why do men do this? Why do women do this? It might just be because of bad storytelling.
Maybe. Yeah, wasn't it in Amanda's narration that she said, with a friend like Sylvia, you don't need enemies?
Yeah.
She's like, well, we got a picture of who Sylvia is. Yeah, for sure. So overall, is this film feminist or sexist / misogynist?
Yeah, it would not be my go-to if I were to empower my local Girl Scout troop with a movie or something. Jeez. Yeah, I don't know if this would crack the top 10. I think it would be, I don't know, I gotta think that there are even more, like, better examples at the time. Because, I mean, this is coming in the mid-50s. We've already had, like, film noir, where you had women expressing themselves in wild and different ways, although usually considered bad, but, you know, could be extrapolated. And in this case, I think that it reaches for certain things we think, like, you know, community and friendship. And those are important, and I think maybe often overlooked in movies these days. I feel like maybe our conception of feminism does tend to be a bit more, or just like empowerment tends to be self-empowerment. But I think we always run into that wall again and again, where it's like, well, solidarity and intersectionality is important. In this case, intersectionality is somewhat limited by the fact that we are in, you know, Park Avenue or Fifth Avenue. So, yeah, being a mixed bag, I would say that there are probably stronger examples of things that are more feminist that I would go to than this one.
Yeah. It's a both answer. And I think there are some aspects of feminism that kind of peek through, but then they're just overshadowed, I think, by lots of sexism and misogyny. Yeah, the gaze, I feel like this film is more male gazy than the 1939 version.
Mm. I mean, do you think that's just like where movies were at in the 50s versus the 30s?
I think that might be, maybe, yes. ? I know that when I was trying to coerce Coca back on here, she said, you know, if I'm upset by this 39 version, I can only imagine how upset I'll be with the 56 version. Yeah. And I think that's true. I mean, it's like gotten, you know, sexier. I guess they're just, you know, allowed to do more. The color certainly added things. Their outfits changed. The bubble bath scene, which there was a bubble bath scene in the 1939 version, but then, I don't know, it just seems like even more. She gets undressed right in front of Kay, which was an interesting scene. Clearly trying to show off her assets. But yeah, inherent, I think, with having showgirls and musicals behind it, you're going to have various stages of undress.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I just saw more of the female body than I did in 1939. So yeah, the morals getting lax in the 50s, huh?
All those kids coming back from the war.
Oh my gosh, those little horn dogs.
Yeah.
Mm-mm-mm. Any final thoughts?
Let's see. Other than two thumbs up, would buy from again?
Well, I assume that you watched this for free because I did.
Yes, this is the first movie I ever watched on Max, which is what HBO Max used to be.
Yeah.
For future archaeologists.
I was super happy about that.
Really?
That this was for free?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I was happy I didn't have spent $3.99 on this.
Yeah, I feel like I might have been a bit buyer's remorse about that. Yeah, I guess I'm surprised that we were even able to sustain a conversation about it. I was kind of worried going in that...
Really?
I thought all my questions would, or all my answers to your questions would be like, well, I didn't really know what was going on, so I can't sufficiently answer this question.
That's very interesting that you were confused by what was happening. I wonder if I would have been confused if I hadn't read the play.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe the answer, I mean, I would say that you're slightly more intelligent than I am. So, well,
it changes.
It's the only time I'll say it. So I'll put a big bleep over it. So yeah. Only you know from now. But if you're confused, then probably I would have been confused.
Maybe, but I also feel like I don't really have the genre familiarity. Mm-hmm. And it could, I mean, maybe it could be a difference of gender.
That might be true, too, yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. The female of the species is the livelier and the deadlier.
Yeah. That's what they say.
That's what they say.
Okay. I do know you're from Mars.
Yes. Mars is a great planet.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that I maybe pleasantly surprised you with my list of questions and the discussion.
Yes, always a pleasant surprise. Well, it's always a surprise with Stella. Whether it's pleasant or not, that depends on...
depends on what's going down, yeah. Okay. Well, before we shoo you off here and disinfect because of your man germs, where can people find and support you?
You can support me with kind words and terms of endearment. You can find my... blog with iZeast at withiZeast.com. I guess that's it. Oh gosh.
Oh my gosh.
I'm forgetting the most crucial element. I do a podcast. Well, I guess there's two. I do a podcast with our mutual friend Donovan called Questions We Don't Have Answers. You can find that at qnoanswers.com, which is about social issues and politics, and very rarely, but sometimes we do have a guest host on, Stella. As we did last time, talking about Die Another Day, which does not sound like a social issue, but there you have it.
And then, made it one.
Yeah, we turned it into an issue anyway, between ourselves. I guess I should also mention that With iZeast is about Asian cinema, just so that people don't have it. It's just a useless URL. And then, of course, there is something that I'm not even sure is legitimate enough to be mentioned on this stage of a podcast, but... I do a video game stream Wednesdays and weekends, maybe Saturday or Sunday, called Ludi et Pugnai with Stella. Our favorite games are Aliens Fireteam Elite and Fall Guys. There, if you tune in, and I sure hope you do, you're going to see a lot of that.
Yes, a lot of playing, and so that's Latin, obviously, for games, and I shouldn't say obviously, games and fights, because we often do get into some sort of kerfluffle, but more often than not, yeah, we just have good conversations, I would say, joke about things, also have, like, deep conversations, sometimes I bring a philosophical question that I'm thinking about, and things like that, like, this could have been, you know, on Ludi et Pugnai, but it had to be elsewhere. So
sad. You're stealing content from our fledgling YouTube empire.
Well, I don't fledgling. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Oh, well, we have 10 subscribers, I think. Yep. Better than none. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for giving me an hour and 56 of your viewing time to watch this film that I going in didn't think I was going to like, and I was thinking, well, I'll just trick him into watching this, and you were tricked. Thank you.
I was sufficiently tricked.
And also, thanks for coming on this show again.
Anytime. It was the hours just flew right by.
Let's eat. You're a little cheap. Oh, I never felt better in my whole life. Let's see, call Wendy's and get Mike Pearl on the phone. Tell him to put on his black tie and get over here fast.
him I'm going big game hunting and I need him.
Lindy's black tie big game hunting? I don't understand.
You will. I've had a whole year to grow claws, Lutzy. Jungle ready.
And finally, we have Operator, Operator, I Have a Call to Make. Now, there were no posts on the previous episode, but there was a post from Facebook from Michael Best. Michael says, I adore the PBS stage on screen version of the original script and the interview excerpts that share about the play and the actors' perspectives on their characters. And Michael gives the YouTube link for that particular video. Michael continues, particularly, I like the tone of the lighthearted banter shared between the facilitators in the last 45 minutes or so of the episode. The diverse perspectives regarding the play, analyses, and the original era were helpful. I'm thankful to catch that the play's Mary and Sylvia characters were cousins. I had not caught that before. I finally heard it in a rewatch of the 39 movie. The element adds more dimension to their interplays. Thank you, Michael, for that. I'm actually interested in watching that video that you linked, and I'm sure I knew that they were cousins when I was reading the play because I'm able to digest and consume more deeply tidbits and details when I'm reading, but for some reason, I think I just missed that particular conversation when I was watching this film. And even when I was watching The Opposite Sex, I don't recall them being cousins. So it's something I'm just going to have to watch out for when I look at the 2008 version to see, are they cousins in this? But thank you very much for posting and writing in. And I hope people come back for this episode. Thank you for listening and see you next time. If you'd like to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network and really give the finger to Sylvia Fowler, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/FWPodcast, where you can make a one-time or monthly contribution and unlock various rewards, including getting name-checked on this or any other network show of your choice, and perhaps you'll become the best friend of Mary Haynes. Support the network and harvest the good fruits. Be sure to subscribe to the show wherever podcasts can be found. Send questions or comments to batgirltooracle@gmail.com. Don't question it. And follow the show at batgirltooracle on Twitter. Thank you, dear listeners, for lending your ears to this show. And until next time, pray do beautiful.